for his face.
D.W. Washburn.
This is your lucky day. A hot bowl of soup is waiting. A hot bowl of soup and a shave.
D.W. Washburn.
We picked you to save.
Listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
California once again leads the country in the number of employees who lost their jobs to mass layoff action. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that during the month of June, California reported 39,179 lost jobs in mass layoffs, bringing the state's total for 2004 to more than 210,000, 26% of the national total. The country as a whole saw nearly 135,000 workers lose their jobs in mass layoffs during the month of June. New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida also saw massive numbers of mass layoffs, with Ohio's total for the year growing to more than 39,000 and Florida's 45,000.
On Sunday, the AFL-CIO sponsored a labor forum for the Democratic National Convention. This reporter was in Boston speaking with Teamsters Union President James Hoffa about his support for Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry.
I'm convinced that he believes that the CAFTA is wrong. He's against it, and what we're going to do is to change those laws. We're going to have trade bills in the future. It's not like we're going to build a wall around that. We want to trade, but we want fair trade. We want people to buy our products, and right now it's a one-way street. They don't buy our products. They erect barriers. We can't sell in their markets, but they can come over here and sell to us. That's elementary, unfair. We're not going to have any more of that. He agrees with that. When we try and ship products to China, there's all kinds of regulations, tariffs, and red tape that ties us up so we can't sell American products in China or India or even Japan. And that is wrong. And South Korea, too. And these one-sided agreements are basically handicapping the American worker. We can't sell good American products, good American cars in these markets. And that's what's got to be changed.
Here's a tip. When you use your credit card to tip your waitstaff, they may not be receiving the amount you intended. Many restaurants across the country deduct credit card processing fees from food service tips. But a current class action lawsuit filed on behalf of servers could affect the way restaurants do business. Two Denver attorneys are currently embattled with Houston restaurant chain Landry's Restaurants Incorporated, who are alleged to deduct at least 3% of the servers' tips to cover credit card processing. A win could result in millions of dollars of back wages for servers throughout the chain, but a loss could have repercussions for waitstaff throughout the country. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to conservative economist Paul Craig Roberts, U.S. job creation in June was focused around employment in the service sector, an area not heavy with competition from workers overseas. Yet Roberts also notes that real wages in America have not kept up with inflation over the past year, and take-home pay as a share of the national economy is at its lowest level since the federal government began tracking it in 1929.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You put in 30 years at the company. You got good pay, health care. Then they send your job overseas. And under George Bush, the company actually gets a tax break for doing it. Now, Bush says we're in recovery. And after a year, you finally land another job. And you wonder, is this what you worked your whole life for? We're not being led. We're being misled.
See George. See George International Parks. George knows parks are popular. George likes to go to parks and have the media take his picture there. See George run for president. In his 2000 presidential run, George W. dressed up in khakis and held a photo op in a national park where he decried the $5 billion backlog in making essential repairs to America's deteriorating park system. It's shameful, he said, promising to fix our parks. He didn't. 4 years later, the maintenance need is $6 billion. Speaking of deterioration, Bush's National Park Service announced this February that it would allow BNP Petroleum Corporation to drill for natural gas on Padre Island National Seashore. This will put pipelines, heavy equipment, and large trucks on the longest undeveloped beach in America. Just what you want to see when you go to the solace of the seashore, a drilling rig in your face. It will hurt tourism, the ecosystem, wildlife, and local businesses. Also, one oil corporation can plunder a minor gas deposit that amounts to only one day's worth of fuel for America. Then there's Georgia's effort to, quote, improve Eisenhower Public Park in Nassau County, New York. Though it's a mere county park, the White House directed county officials to make an essential addition to Eisenhower Park prior to Bush's visit there in March. He was going for a fundraiser in a restaurant in the park. Then he was going to walk to a building to meet with some families of 9/11 victims, then proceed to a groundbreaking ceremony for a 9/11 memorial to be built in the park. The new addition demanded by Bush's minions? Sidewalks along every step of Bush's trek. Newsday columnist Jimmy Breslin reports that the word came down from on high. The president's feet are not to touch the dirt. This is Jim Hightower saying, thus, concrete and asphalt were poured so George's feet would not touch the ground, as they rarely have any time in his life.
As a small business owner, doing several things all at the same time is just another day at the office. So Sam's Club offers the option of doing two things at once, buying items you need for your business, while at the same time buying items you need for your home. When you shop at Sam's Club, you get the same everyday low costs on items for your home as you do on items for your business. You've got a lot going on. Count on us to help you get it done. Sam's Club. We are in business for small business.
I'm Jim Hightower, and I've approved this message.
Jim Hightower is not running for office, but he is back this campaign season with an important word about the regime of King George W.
Let's stop beating around the bush. These people are nuts.
Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush is Hightower's hilarious new best-selling book, offering you unvarnished facts, insight, and humor to get you through this year's political spin cycle. Buy Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush today and make politics fun again. Available at bookstores everywhere and on the web at jimhightower.com. Buy it today.
Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, I suppose it was predictable. Should have seen it coming. They can't win on the issues. The Republicans this year, or broadly, it's coming down to Republican and Democrat, but it's really the conservatives, because there are a few conservative Democrats and there are some actually fairly reasonable Republicans out there. But the bottom line is that the conservatives can't win on the issues. Oh, yes, we want to wipe out the middle class. We want to turn the middle class of America into the working poor because it'll be more profitable for corporations. Yeah, that's what we want to do. I don't think that's going to fly. You know, it's kind of around the edge, you know. In the last 3 years, the years of the Bush misadministration, we've seen that workers' share of America's yearly national income has shrunk from 66.9% of national income to 62.9%. In other words, the paycheck of the average person in America has dropped as a percentage of GDP. These are figures from the Fed, from the Federal Reserve Bank. You know, it's just very, very straightforward, clean stuff. And yet corporate profits, not revenue, profits have soared from 8.2% of GDP to 12%. 4%. So wages go down 4%. Corporate profits, as 4% of GDP, they drop. Corporate profits go up 3.8%. That's the conservative agenda, or one dimension of it. And then, well, you know, let's go get the oil in Iraq. Exxon will be very happy. You know, they can't win on the issues. How many lies, distortions, dirty tricks, and character assassinations will the American people tolerate from the right-wing extremists in the RNC and the Bush campaign before they realize how much these right-wingers hate democracy? The cover, the front page of Drudge Report today, Teresa Hines, doesn't even call her Teresa Hines Carey, right? I mean, Teresa Hines unearthed. I don't trust Ted Kennedy. Democrats putrid. Apparently the Boston Herald, which is the right-wing newspaper in Boston, newspaper in Boston, is going to be running an interview with Teresa, well, back when she was Teresa Hines. I suppose we could say Mr. Drudge is accurate, somewhat. From years ago, when she was in another political party, married to another person, she said she didn't like Ted Kennedy. That is going to be the news today. And the fact that she said, shove it, to a journalist. Because when she talked about un-American traits, he came back and said, what's this un-American activity you're talking about? And she was on TV this morning going, you know, un-American activity, that's Joe McCarthy. That's not what I was talking about. This guy's, you know, right-wing rag pushing. How long is it going to, you know, the issues are not with the conservatives this year. I mean, you've got them hysterical. You know, their voices are getting higher and higher and higher as they're running around the country going, ah, there's more jobs, there's more jobs, look at this, more jobs that pay less. That pay a lot less. The new jobs that are being created pay, on average, 23% less than the jobs that are lost. Why? Conservative economic policies. They say, well, the average American is getting a tax break of over $1,000. Well, if you and I are sitting in a bar, and between us, well, it doesn't matter what our income is, and Bill Gates walks into the bar, suddenly the average income of all three of us becomes somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 billion. Or the average net worth. Look out for the word average. Middle class families in America, by and large, got about $100 out of George Bush's 3 years of so-called tax cuts and are going to have to pay it back somewhere in the neighborhood of $25,000 to $30,000. Over the course of the next 20 to 30 years. Because that's how much of their wealth, well, that's how much was borrowed in their names, principally from Japan and China, and wealthy families in the United States who buy treasuries. That's how much was borrowed in our names and will have to be paid back and given to the wealthiest 1% of Americans by the Bush administration, and that we are going to have to pay back if this administration does not change this year. If things don't change, it's going to get even worse. But, you know, I started out with a rant. Greetings! Hi, Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast. Our number 1-866-889-8894. You can find links to our chat room, which is live and full of folks at tomhartman.com. Also to our message board, where you can post messages and read the tens of thousands of messages posted there on various topics having to do with talk radio and politics and economics and pretty much everything else, attention deficit disorder even, which I've written a bunch of books on. I did a workshop, actually, at Omega this weekend on it. And, of course, radiopower.org, streaming us around the planet, our archives at White Rose Society, and on the website Mike Toth has put there. I watched the convention coverage last night. And, of course, the convention opened with the obligatory, showing up of Terry McAuliffe, a fellow that, if he pulls this thing out of the hat in November, I'll salute him. I have a lot of reservations about Terry McAuliffe, but I'll salute him on November 2nd if John Kerry and Democrats, particularly if the Democrats take back the House and Senate.
The 44th Quadrennial National Convention of the Democratic Party will now come to order.
There you go. You noticed it was the Democratic Party and not the Democrat Party, because there ain't no such thing as the Democrat Party except in the minds of Newt Gingrich. And I want to get you to the mind of Newt Gingrich in just a moment. He has issued marching orders to his minions, essentially saying what I've been saying. We, the Republicans, cannot win on the issues. So the Hill reports yesterday. The Hill is the insider newspaper on Capitol Hill. It's read all by all the politicians. Former Speaker Newt Gingrich has advised Republicans to focus this year's presidential campaign on a few wedge issues. One GOP lawmaker told The Hill that Gingrich encouraged Republicans to pick issues such as school prayers, strengthening work requirements for welfare recipients, and barring the United Nations from monitoring U.S. elections. Why? Because in their polling, they found that those three issues polled at higher than 80%. More than 80% of Americans agree with them on these three issues. And school prayer, strengthening work requirements for welfare recipients, and barring the United Nations from coming into the United States and monitoring our elections. These are the wedge issues that Newt Gingrich is telling the Republicans they should be going with. Representative Phil English, a congressman from Pennsylvania, says, and I quote, "We have a very good wedge issue." The Hill also notes that at this meeting where Gingrich spoke, Republican lawmakers glimpsed President Bush's agenda for a possible second term. I've told you this before. He's going to call it the ownership society. And sure enough, the president touched on giving voters ownership in health care, housing, and retirement accounts, but did not delve into specifics. What does this mean? It means, hey, your health care, you own it. Good luck. Your retirement? Oh, you own it! Good luck! You thought you had Social Security? Sorry. You thought there was Medicaid? You'd like us to be like every other country in the world and have a national health care system? Or have the government have some control over the prices of drugs? Yeah, sorry. You let a conservative in. 1-866-889-8895. But that wasn't the most important speech that was given last night. The most important speech last night was given by the Reverend David Alston, and I want to get to that in just a second. First, let's pick up this call from Glenn in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, Glenn, what's up?
Well, I heard something last night when you talked about average income, and I think they said over the last 10 years, I think they were talking about the top 10%, not just top 1%, whose incomes had gone up 150%, while the average person's income, the other 80% of us or something, had gone up 10%. Now, that's just not right.
Yeah, and in fact, if you look over the last 3.5 years, the average income of just the middle class in the United States has actually dropped.
It's actually dropped
when you adjust it for inflation. It's been going up slower than the rate of inflation. Very straightforward. Glenn, thanks for raising that and for bringing it up. 17 minutes past the hour. David Alston, I was horrified. I was absolutely horrified. I'm watching MSNBC, Chris Matthews, And I forget who had spoken. I think it was Al Gore. And then they introduce the next person. It's Reverend David Alston, A-L-S-T-O-N, Alston, I'm assuming. And they introduce him as one of the guys who was on one of the Swift boats with John Kerry in Vietnam. And I thought, this is going to be, and this is prime time. This is prime time. It's like 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, something like that, 9:30, whatever, right there for America to watch. Terry McAuliffe put this guy on there because he has one of the most important messages about John Kerry. And I'm going, this is great. I want to hear what he has to say. And it's going to be a relatively short speech. I have the transcript of it here in front of me. It couldn't have been more than 12 minutes. And MSNBC cuts away and goes to a bunch of talking heads. And instead of listening to David Alston, the Reverend David Alston, who was with John Kerry in Vietnam in the Swift Boat, we get to listen to Joe Scarborough. I wanted to barf. I'm sorry. I was horrified. I mean, what? So I said, flipping around the channels, and all CNN has gone to talking heads. And they got a con on there, too. You know, oh, we're going to be balanced. Yeah. Come on. And it was only PBS. Finally, I got to PBS, Public Broadcasting, and they played David Alston. And I heard one of the most absolutely extraordinary speeches of the convention. And odds are you didn't hear it. I can't find an audio clip of it here. All the networks, you know, they've got all these little audio clips. And I got pieces I'm going to share with you as the day goes on of other speeches. But I do have the transcript, and I want to share it with you here right after this break, because I think it's just extraordinary what this guy said about his experience having his life depend on John Kerry. Meanwhile, the right-wingers will be going after Teresa. Exploit any weakness. Go after the human. The politics of human destruction. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
I'm sorry. There's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told if you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about The Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Hey, what does this word make you think of? Tchaikovsky.
Isn't it? So what's the word?
No, that is the word.
You lost me.
All right, who's Martha Graham?
She invented the graham cracker. Before her, there was only soda crackers.
Maybe they're not getting enough art. Kids who participate in the arts do better in school and in life. To learn more, visit AmericansForTheArts.org. Because all kids should get to appreciate Tchaikovsky's music and Martha Graham's dance. Art. Ask for more. A public service message brought to you by Americans for the Arts and the Ad Council.
How can contemporary America possibly compare with 1933 Germany? Find out in Tom Hartman's brand new fully illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America. Through Tom's concise political analysis and Neil Cohn's vibrant illustrations, you'll observe an unsettling, if not shocking, perspective of America. You'll also hear what the founders of this country did to control corporate power. You'll be invited to consider how the American political system can be made more democratic, as well as comprehend the Project for the New American Century's vision for America. Here's what syndicated cartoonist Ted Rawl said after reading We the People.
An ambitious effort to explain everything that's wrong in America, how things got this way, and what should be done about it. We the People is the product of a brilliant and principled thinker.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Available in bookstores everywhere.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Brad in Brooklyn, New York is on the line. Hey, Brad, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Brad.
Why weren't you watching C-SPAN?
Yeah, well... You know, the people in the chat room are taking me to task for that right as we speak.
I was going to say, they've started their coverage at 3 o'clock, so it was an hour of, you know, BS ahead of time. But
yeah.
But then right from 4 o'clock on, gavel to gavel.
Just straight through, yeah.
No interruptions, no talking heads.
Well, you know, it was useful, actually, to get a little talking heads here and there, to,
sure.
just to see how the right-wingers were spinning things. But... This particular speech, I felt, was a really important one, and I'm going to share pieces of it here as we go along.
Good. No, I really enjoyed the speeches last night. I mean, I thought Gore was really funny. My favorite line had to have been, you know, everybody knows the saying, you win some, you lose some, and then there's that third lesser-known category.
Right. Yeah, he did good. He did good. Al Gore's...
And I think Hillary might have been on... A little bit longer than they expected, but I surely enjoyed listening to her, too.
Yeah, she did a good job. She, we'll see what her political future is. I mean, you know, for all the right-wing cranking and moaning about how she's upset, she doesn't want them to win, she wants to run for president in 4 years, blah-de-blah-de-blah, you know, I think that she's really concerned first about what's best for the country.
Do you know if there are any Republican women senators? I noticed they had 9 Democrats.
Sure, Olympia Snowe from Maine.
Maine?
Immediately comes to mind.
Okay. I noticed both the senators from California and from Washington were women.
Yeah.
And Democrats.
Yeah. There's a fair number of women in the Senate and in the House. So. Anyhow, got to boogie along here, Brad.
Definitely.
Okay. Talk to you later. There were 6 of us aboard PCF 94, says Reverend David Alston, a 50-foot twin-engine craft known as a swift boat. We came from all different walks of life, but all of us, including our skipper, John Kerry, volunteered for combat duty, and combat is what we got. He goes on to say, we usually patrolled the narrow waterways of the Mekong Delta, flanked on both sides by thick jungle. As our crewmate, Gene Thorson, put it, we were traveling bullseye, and we often came under sudden attack from the enemy hidden in the shadows. Machine gun fire, rocket-propelled grenades, it all came fast and furious, and Lieutenant Kerry had to make quick life-or-death decisions for the entire boat. This is the Reverend David Alston speaking last night. Now, keep in mind, the Swift boat is a little different than, I guess at this time George W. was... you know, sitting in a bar in Alabama, so I'm not quite sure that there's any kind of comparison. But anyhow, he says, you have to realize a swift boat isn't armored. The hull is aluminum, about as thick as 2 nickels. And in the middle of a narrow river or canal with no cover at all, even small caliber bullets could punch right through it, and often did. Manning the deck guns, most of us got wounded sooner or later, including Lieutenant Kerry. It would have been easiest in an ambush to simply rake the shore with return fire and roar down the river to safety. But Lieutenant Kerry was known for taking the fight straight to the enemy. I can still see him now, standing in the doorway of the pilot house, firing his M16, shouting orders through the smoke and chaos. Once he even directed the helmsman to beach the boat right into the teeth of an ambush and pursued our attackers on foot into the jungle. In the toughest of situations, Lieutenant Carey showed judgment, loyalty, and courage. Even wounded or confronting sights no man should ever have to see, he never lost his cool. And when the shooting stopped, he was also there, too, with a caring hand on my shoulder, asking, "Gunner, are you okay?" I was only 21, running on fear and adrenaline. Lieutenant Carey always took the time to calm us down, to bring us back to reality, to give us hope, to show us what we truly had within ourselves. I came to love and respect him as a man I could trust with life itself. This from a man who's the pastor of a church now in South Carolina, the Reverend David Alston, who had been on the boat, on the Swift boat in Vietnam with John Kerry back in the late 1960s. One of the speeches you probably didn't hear last night if you were watching the networks or even most of the cable stations, I should have been watching C-SPAN or PBS, as Brad points out. Anyhow, it's great. Tom Hartman with you, 29 minutes past the hour. For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
California once again leads the country in the number of employees who lost their jobs to mass layoff action. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that during the month of June, California reported 39,179 lost jobs in mass layoffs, bringing the state's total for 2004 to more than 210,000, 26% of the national total. The country as a whole saw nearly 135,000 workers lose their jobs in mass layoffs during the month of June. New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida also saw massive numbers of mass layoffs, with Ohio's total for the year growing to more than 39,000 and Florida's 45,000.
On Sunday, the AFL-CIO sponsored a labor forum for the Democratic National Convention. This reporter was in Boston speaking with Teamsters Union President James Hoffa about his support for Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry.
I'm convinced that he believes that the CAFTA is wrong. He's against it, and what we're going to do is to change those laws. We're going to have trade bills in the future. It's not like we're going to build a wall around that. We want to trade, but we want fair trade. We want people to buy our products. And right now, it's a one-way street. They don't buy our products. They erect barriers. We can't sell in their markets. But they can come over here and sell to us. That's elementary, unfair. We're not going to have any more of that, and he agrees with that. When we try and ship products to China, there's all kinds of regulations, tariffs, and red tape that ties us up so we can't sell American products in China or India or even Japan. And that is wrong. And South Korea, too. And these one-sided agreements are basically handicapping the American worker. We can't sell good American products, good American cars in these markets. And that's what's got to be changed.
Here's a tip. When you use your credit card to tip your waitstaff, they may not be receiving the amount you intended. Many restaurants across the country deduct credit card processing fees from food servers' tips, but a current class action lawsuit filed on behalf of servers could affect the way restaurants do business. Two Denver attorneys are currently embattled with Houston restaurant chain Landry's Restaurants Incorporated, who are alleged to deduct at least 3% of the servers' tips to cover credit card processing. A win could result in millions of dollars of back wages for servers throughout the chain, but a loss could have repercussions for waitstaff throughout the country. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to conservative economist Paul Craig Roberts, U.S. job creation in June was focused around employment in the service sector, an area not heavy with competition from workers overseas. Yet Roberts also notes that real wages in America have not kept up with inflation over the past year, and take-home pay as a share of the national economy is at its lowest level since the federal government began tracking it in 1929.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. That's got to be the strangest bit of bumper music. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 26 and a half minutes before the hour. Newt Gingrich said it best. Go for the wedge issues. In fact, just go for a few of the wedge issues. Because, implicitly, the Republicans will lose if they go on their real agenda. They will lose big. They will lose bad. And the polling is just fascinating. I got a Zogby poll here. And also some information on how the whole story of the convention is being spun by the media. First, a few just quick sound bites from the weekend here. Here's Al Gore.
Take it from me, every vote counts.
Yeah, a bit of an understatement there.
In our democracy, every vote has power. And never forget that power is yours. Don't let anyone take it away from you or talk you into throwing it away.
Yeah, and he's not going to do that again either, I don't think. And Jimmy Carter, in the third hour of our program, actually, I want to play a good chunk of Jimmy Carter's speech because it's so brilliant. I want to just break it down for you. But here's just a little snapshot of Jimmy Carter's comments.
What a difference these few months of extremism have made.
These few months of extremism, 40-some-odd months, actually, 3 years, but nonetheless.
The United States has alienated its allies, dismayed its friends, and inadvertently gratified its enemies by proclaiming a confused and disturbing strategy of preemptive war.
Something that the last country in the 20th century to claim the right to preemptive war was Germany in the 1930s, and then before that it was, the Roman Empire, the Greek Empire. Well, there were a few along the way. Anyhow, Jimmy Carter.
With our allies disunited, the world resenting us, and the Middle East ablaze, we need John Kerry to restore life to the global war against terrorism.
Good plan there, Jimmy. Thank you very much. And the big point he made was about the Middle East. I mean, this is the thing that Carter is absolutely passionate about. He started the Camp David process. He won the Nobel Prize for getting them within spitting distance of a peace accord. And every president before him, basically since the creation of Israel, and since him. I mean, he was one of the real leaders in championing it, but every president, with the exception of George W. Bush, has played an active role in trying to bring about peace in the Middle East. And frankly, I would say, if it hadn't been for Yasser Arafat's absolute and utter incompetence, Bill Clinton could have pulled it off. I mean, those guys offered Arafat a deal that was... Well, let's not get into that. Anyway, here's Bill Clinton wrapping the thing up.
Their opponents will tell you we should be afraid of John Kerry and John Edwards because they won't stand up to the terrorists. Don't you believe it? Strength and wisdom are not opposing values.
Yeah. That had to be the punchline. They go hand in hand. That had to be the punchline for the evening. Strength and wisdom are not opposing values. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Kevin in Tampa, Florida is on the line. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing today?
Great, but I'll get better.
One side note before what I called about. I love that phrase when Bill Clinton gave that out last night.
Yeah, yeah.
That just about said it all.
Strength and wisdom are not opposing values. Well, they are. They actually are in the Bush administration. But
right. Anyhow, the reason I called, I saw something on C-SPAN this morning which was very interesting and I think tells a lot about the Bushes. They had on their morning call-in show, Washington Journal, I think it's called, a Republican strategist, I don't recall his name, who's a personal friend of George H.W.
George H.W., the senior.
Right, right. And he first met him, he said, in 77. The thing he liked about him is that he was in an audience and somebody asked Bush, this is Bush Sr., what's the difference between him and Jimmy Carter? And Bush said, Jimmy Carter sees things as they, as he wants them to be. I see things as they are. Hmm. And that brought me right back to that famous thing he said back when he was in office that he doesn't understand about this vision thing.
Right. And
that's their problem. Yeah. They don't have a vision of the way things should be.
Well,
that's
actually,
why,
Kevin,
that's
they
why
do.
They had it's... that problem in Iraq. They had a vision, I guess, of flowers coming out instead of hand grenades.
That's, see, that's it. They do have a vision, Kevin. Their vision, their vision is, you know, is bizarre. It's disconnected from reality, and now they're going to lay a vision on us of an ownership society. You want health care? Hey, you get to own it. Yes. It's not our problem. And you want Social Security? Well, you can own it. Yes, indeed. You know, you don't need to. And, yeah.
But you see, that's not real vision.
No.
And Bush said that himself. The dad did. Back while he was president, you'll recall him saying that.
Oh, sure.
That he didn't understand this vision thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And then this guy said that he said that about Jimmy Carter back in 77. And that's the difference.
Yeah, it's Bobby Kennedy's famous paraphrasing of, I believe it was Walt Whitman, who said, some people see things as they are and ask why.
Right.
I see things as they could be and ask why not.
That's right.
And, yeah.
And that's the whole clue.
Yeah. Yeah, well said, Kevin. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us.
Okay, bye-bye.
You're welcome. Thank you. We start by assuming, says John Zogby, that the District of Columbia and the 34 states that aren't in the battleground analysis will vote for the same political party they did in 2000. So you got 34 states that are pretty much just not even in the mix. And according to the polling, you know, they're lopsided enough, either in favor of Kerry or in favor of Bush, that they're predictable. I'm not sure I entirely buy that in all cases, but anyway, we'll go along with this. Thus, President Bush, he says, begins with 189 electoral votes and Kerry with 172. You need 270 to win. So then we look at the rest of the states, the 16 battleground states. And he says, according to his latest poll, Kerry leads in 12 states worth a total of 119 electoral votes, and Bush leads in 4 states worth a total of 58 electoral votes. Therefore, Kerry has a 291 to 247 lead. It sounds like good news for Kerry. However, his lead used to be 322 to 205. It used to be even bigger. So Kerry's slipping a little, although he's still ahead. And I would say this is... in some part because the Republicans have been doing just a massive smear campaign, lying about him and his record, and frankly the Democrats haven't been responding in kind at all. They haven't been pointing out the deficiencies in Bush's record, Bush's incredible history of flip flops, for example. You know, they're trying to portray Kerry as a flip flopper, and you spend 20 years in the Senate, you are going to take different positions on different issues over time as A, issues are presented in different ways. Like, do you vote for this bill if it's not funded? Do you vote for this bill if it has attached to it something that's really obnoxious? You know, of course, anybody who's been in the Senate for 20 years, you can find evidence. You know, apparently they've been... But Bush, I mean, you know, he's against the 9/11 commission. Then he's in favor of it. Then he's against it. Then they want extra time. He's not going to give them extra. This 9/11 commission would never have happened if George Bush hadn't flip flopped. And then he flip flopped again and tried to kill it off. And then the pressure from the families, as just, you know, one example. We've been going through our flip flops for some time here, but anyhow, so it's looking kind of scary here. For George Bush, the bottom line right now, if you strip out those states with less than 3 percentage point margins, which is the margin of error, Kerry still has 257 electoral votes, writes John Bitzogby. From there, he could reach 270 by picking up just one additional state. Strip away Mr. Bush's under 3-point states, and his tally falls to 194. The Republicans are getting desperate. 1-866-889-8894, Dave in Humboldt County, California on the line. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Well, good morning, Tom.
We have gone from coast to coast, from Brad in New York to you and on the sea coast there in California.
Yeah, well, you're doing another excellent program. I've got so many thoughts on it, but just a couple for you. I'd be very suspicious of polls right now, too, because the very same high-tech goons that put Bush in office and intends to keep him in office. Wherever any major Time, Newsweek poll accumulates all the data and starts feeding it into a computer, these guys go right into that computer, and the data that comes out, they will have had an effect on it. But
well, I would think, Dave, that there may be some truth and legitimacy to that concern if it wasn't for the fact that there are, you know, the Pew organization, which is pretty solid, is doing some polling. Zogby seems to be fairly nonpartisan. He's doing polling. You've got the networks doing polling. But the thing that I find most but the problem is that we're so far out right now that the polls are going to be very fluid for a while. Plus, you've got the probabilities of October surprises, actually from both sides, you know, coming down the road.
Computers themselves can be invaded by our own high-tech folks. I'm very knowledgeable on what I'm speaking of.
No, I agree with you, but I suspect that those expert hackers are waiting for November 2nd to go after the voting machines instead of the polling machines.
They're going to try to make it look like it's close, even if it's nowhere near close.
Yeah, but the thing that I think is really interesting about these polls right now, Dave, is that they're showing that there is such, you know, the Republicans were saying, well, traditionally you get a 15% bounce coming out of the convention. Well, that's because traditionally 15% of the voters, far more, you know, traditionally 20, 30, 40% of the voters haven't made up their mind until the first convention.
Well,
and then they start making up their mind. We got a situation now where you got only about 10, 12% of Americans are saying that they haven't made up their mind. This tells me that George Bush from day one has been a divider, not a uniter, that people have held positions for years. They're still feeling ripped off from having the Supreme Court give him the presidency, for example.
I find myself trying to analyze how can any significant number of people get themselves supporting a corrupt, imperialistic, corporatist type of a government. And I know at the very top end you've got pure unfiltered greed. And I see at the bottom end, surprisingly enough, there is a sexual panic. There's a need on the part of a lot of our American males to get behind the most anti-gay candidate. You know?
Sure.
Like, I think that hurt Clinton badly. Clinton was pro-gay. If I'm pro-Clinton, won't people be suspicious? And that kind of panic just went rampant. But it is that kind of a wedge issue. Maybe there is also some of the fundamentalists and their fears with respect to embryos and whatnot, but I can't imagine many people not seeing what they're up against right now. I felt a real pride, as you did and a lot of your callers, with hearing some very credible Democrats last night. I think they would have had an impact on a lot of people.
Yeah. I agree, Dave, and I just wish more people had heard them. Thanks for calling and pointing that out.
Thank you for being there, Tom.
Sure, you're absolutely welcome, Dave. And my point about, you know, wishing more of them had heard it is here the Boston Globe today runs this story. Last night, apparently, there was a public seminar or whatever, a forum, yesterday's forum, they called it. And Dan Rather, Peter Jennings, Tom Brokaw, Jim Lehrer. Jim Lehrer rebuked the big three anchors for their network's decision to air only 3 hours of primetime coverage at each national convention this summer. 3 hours of primetime. And Dan Rather offers this kind of weaselly, well, we have no influence over CBS's decisions on how much of the convention to air. And his the people with him, you know, Brokaw and Jennings, they say, well, you know, this thing is so pre-programmed, it's not news. And Lehrer just comes right back. He says, we're not in the business of telling the parties how to run the conventions. We're in the news business. He says, this is important stuff. This is about the future of the United States. And then they start talking about, you know, apparently what is really concerning them. And Dan Rather says, the anchors, well, here's the Boston Globe. The anchors acknowledge the impact of criticism and pressure, often from conservatives, that pours into their networks at unprecedented levels. You know, Richard Mellon, Scaife, and these guys cranking all this money into the right-wing hysteria machine. Dan Rather stated that, quote, fear has increased in every newsroom in America, end quote, and added that reporting on explosive issues can bring a torrent of emails and phone calls. That can lead to a situation, he said, in which journalists conclude, quote, when you run this story, you're asking for trouble with a capital T, why run it, end quote. Brokaw, referring to the president, I'm reading here from the Boston Globe, referring to the president of the conservative watchdog organization Media Research Center, said conservatives, quote, feel like they have to go to war against the networks every day, end quote. Jennings added, quote, I hear more about conservative concerns than I have in the past. This wave of resentment rushes at our advertisers, rushes at our corporate suites. I feel the presence of anger all the time, end quote. The angry Reich. The angry Reich, trying to bring down the media of America, or turn it all into Fox, right? Foxify the whole thing. Although Jennings defended the Boston Globe, says ABC's coverage of the period leading up to the war in Iraq, several of yesterday's speakers agreed that their news outlets had not been aggressive enough in examining the Bush administration's rationale for the conflict. Gee, I wonder why. Well, because, you know, they're scared. They are successfully being intimidated by the right wing, and the very well-financed right wing, and you know, folks like former Enron lobbyist Ed Gillespie, heading up the RNC, and just, you know, this whole absolute whole thing. 1-866-889-8894. Tony in Waukegan, Illinois, on the line. Hey, Tony, only got about a half a minute here left before we got to take a break. What's up?
Hey, you know how you were just talking about the guys who are both the networks and PBS?
Yeah.
Jim Lehrer. See, this is why Jim Lehrer and PBS are so important, and this assault on PBS is really going to hurt us all if the Republicans get their way and make this thing like what they're doing with Tucker Carlson and all these other guys.
Oh, I agree. They're putting a couple of right-wingers onto PBS. Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. Tony, thanks for the call, and thanks for raising that issue. The assault of public broadcasting in the United States. No, we don't want something like the BBC that just tells the news. We want to have the right-wing opinions out there, too. Yeah. 10 minutes before they are.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. Join me this October as we explore Greece, the ancient birthplace of democracy. When the Founding Fathers were searching for the best and fairest form of government, they studied the models of Athenian democracy. We'll explore together this part of the ancient world where the ideas that today animate modern democracy were first worked out. This journey is set on the shore of the sparkling Mediterranean Sea with the sacred mountains of Crete behind us. We'll visit the ancient site of Gortian, famous for the Law Code of Gortian, large 6th century BC tablets of stone built into a wall and one of the first examples of laws ever written down, and now the oldest still in existence. I'll teach workshops at the two most important sites in all of Crete, Knossos and Phaistos, plus more. At Knossos, we'll experience the main ceremonial center and the palace of King Minos. For information on how you can join us on this trip of a lifetime, visit www.tomhartman.com or call 1-800-234-TOUR. That's 1-800-234-TOUR, T-O-U-R.
Tom Hartman will be speaking out in Santa Fe, New Mexico with We the People, a call to take back America, a Friday evening talk August 27th at the Santa Fe Armory for the Arts, to be followed by a Saturday, August 28th workshop called Waking Up to Personal and Global Transformation. Tom Hartman brings his wit, wisdom, and intelligence to Santa Fe the weekend of August 27th and 28th. Tom Hartman will discuss with us how America faces its greatest threat since a civil war. And Tom Hartman will look at how Western thinking, legends, and myths have caused global problems and endangered democracy and what we can do about it. To get your tickets and more information, call 505-988-2223 in Santa Fe. That's 505-988-2223 or visit greatmystery.org. Tickets for Tom Hartman are also available at Collected Works Bookstore in Santa Fe.
Mega media giant Clear Channel Communications refused to allow an anti-war group to buy space on a billboard in Times Square during the Republican National Convention through Election Day. But public pressure forced Clear Channel to finally accept an ad showing a giant peace dove and a ticker displaying the cost of the war in Iraq in dollars. The 150-foot-long sign will be displayed at Broadway and 42nd Street. WIN correspondent Rebecca Miles reports.
Project Billboard, an anti-war group based in California and interested in encouraging public debate, filed a lawsuit against Clear Channel Communications alleging breach of contract. What is at stake is a billboard advertisement that Project Billboard contracted to run with Clear Channel. The advertisement featured a red, white, blue character of a bomb with the caption, "Democracy is better taught by example, not by war." Clear Channel rejected the first advertisement, saying they were not going to run bomb copy in New York City. Project Billboard then replaced the bomb image with a red and white blue dove, accompanied by the same words, but this was also rejected. They claimed that Clear Channel had suggested that the billboard be an image of a little girl waving a flag. Clear Channel Communications is one of the nation's largest media companies with close ties to National Republicans. I asked Deborah Rappaport, founder of the Project Billboard, whether she thought the debate had begun, as Clear Channel Communications' rejection of the billboard had started a flurry of debate in television and newspaper stories.
This was never our intent to get into any sort of a fight like this. We're not unhappy that our message is getting out, but we would be many, many, many times happier if it were getting out in the mode that we had chosen.
We put a call into Clear Channel Communications for comment, but it by news broadcast had no response. For the Workers Independent News Service, I'm Rebecca Miles in...
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 4.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you at the...
Here at the Spawn of Satan Convention in Boston.
All right, it's Ann Coulter. She of the large Adam's apple, I suppose. Conservatives are deploying a series of covert signals to identify one another, much like gay men do, she read. This is the lead sentence. It's incredible. Somebody at USA Today, I mean, here I am talking about it, giving her free press. It's really very clever. She got some dopey editor at USA Today to say, great, let's have Ann Coulter cover the DNC, cover the convention, the Democratic National Convention. And she writes this thing up, and it's just, apparently the nuts at the Democratic National Convention are going to be put in cages outside the convention hall. I thought this was a great idea until I realized the nut category did not include Sharpton, Gore, Clinton, and Kennedy. Yeah. There's a, in the middle of that, she said, sadly, they won't be fighting to death, as is done in the WWF caged matches. And she says, they're calling this the protesters area, although I suppose a better name would be the truth-free zone. So she gets them to go along with this, and then she submits this story, which she knows they're not going to run. And they, of course, cancel it. And now she's got a hook to get on all the news programs. Should be pretty transparent, don't you think? You know. It's tragic. But, you know, the thing that I find really interesting... And this issue that she raises about the cages, the free speech zone outside, is that it seems as though the Republican protesters are not being herded into the free speech zone. That the people who are protesting are the people who are protesting Bush's policies. They're protesting George, but, you know, the people with hoods on their heads and, you know, looking like looking like captives at Abu Ghraib and things like that. It'll be interesting to see how different it may be in New York. But I thought that was an interesting non sequitur or something. It is an oddity, shall we say. An oddity. Anyhow, the DNC, the convention is continuing. We will be continuing to cover it. For more news, information, and insights here on the Tom Hartman Program. The True People's Radio, the place where smart people get their news.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hart.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
California once again leads the country in the number of employees who lost their jobs to mass layoff action. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that during the month of June, California reported 39,179 lost jobs in mass layoffs, bringing the state's total for 2004 to more than 210,000, 26% of the national total. The country as a whole saw nearly 135,000 workers lose their jobs in mass layoffs during the month of June. New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida also saw massive numbers of mass layoffs, with Ohio's total for the year growing to more than 39,000 and Florida's 45,000.
On Sunday, the AFL-CIO sponsored a labor forum for the Democratic National Convention. This reporter was in Boston speaking with Teamsters Union President James Hoffa about his support for Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry.
I'm convinced that he believes that the CAFTA is wrong. He's against it, and what we're going to do is to change those laws. We're going to have trade bills in the future. It's not like we're going to build a wall around that. We want to trade, but we want fair trade. We want people to buy our products, and right now it's a one-way street. They don't buy our products. They erect barriers. We can't sell in their markets, but they can come over here and sell to us. That's elementary, unfair. We're not going to have any more of that. He agrees with that. When we try and ship products to China, there's all kinds of regulations, tariffs, and red tape that ties us up so we can't sell American products in China or India or even Japan. And that is wrong, and South Korea too. And these one-sided agreements are basically handicapping the American worker. We can't sell good American products, good American cars in these markets. And that's what's got to be changed.
Here's a tip. When you use your credit card to tip your waitstaff, they may not be receiving the amount you intended. Many restaurants across the country deduct credit card processing fees from food servers' tips, but a current class action lawsuit filed on behalf of servers could affect the way restaurants do business. Two Denver attorneys are currently embattled with Houston restaurant chain Landry's Restaurants Incorporated, who are alleged to deduct at least 3% of the servers' tips to cover credit card processing. A win could result in millions of dollars of back wages for servers throughout the chain, but a loss could have repercussions for waitstaff throughout the country. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to conservative economist Paul Craig Roberts, U.S. job creation in June was focused around employment in the service sector, an area not heavy with competition from workers overseas. Yet Roberts also notes that real wages in America have not kept up with inflation over the past year, and take-home pay as a share of the national economy is at its lowest level since the federal government began tracking it in 1929.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You put in 30 years at the company. You got good pay, health care. Then they send you a job overseas. And under George Bush, the company actually gets a tax break for doing it. Now, Bush says we're in recovery. Then after a year, you finally land another job, and you wonder, is this what you worked your whole life for? We're not being led. We're being misled.
Good news, Americans. The Crawford Five are free. As I reported to you earlier this year, five Texans were victims of one of the most bizarre incidents in George W.'s ongoing autocratic assault on America's most basic liberty, the right to dissent and protest. With a hardy troop of about 100 others, these five citizens were on their way to a peaceful war protest at Bush's ranchette outside the town of Crawford, Texas. As their car caravan proceeded through Crawford to get to George's place, however, they were halted by an impromptu police barricade erected by Chief Donnie Tidmore. The chief told the group they could not protest in Crawford because they had no permit. "But wait," they said, "we don't plan to protest here in town. We're just passing through." They might as well have tried reasoning with a rock wall, for Tidmore was impervious to logic, saying that by driving cars containing protest signs into his town, they were engaged in a de facto demonstration. And he reminded them firmly, they had no permit for that. It was Catch-22 meets Barney Fife. Five of the group tried to talk sense to Donnie, but he was having none of it. So they were arrested, jailed, and later convicted by a Crawford jury for failing to obey Tidmore's order for them to turn around and leave town. Apparently, in Bush world, we the people have the constitutional right to assembly and free speech, but not the right to pass through Crawford to exercise those rights. But the Crawford Five refused to give in to the ludicrous law of Bush world, preferring the freedom-loving mandates laid down by America's founders. So they appealed. Gloriously, just after July 4th, the McLennan County judge presiding over the appeal dismissed all charges against the five and restored our First Amendment rights to their proper preeminent place. This is Jim Hightower saying, stay vigilant, Americans. The forces of ignorance and arrogance are always out there to repress our liberties.
I'm sorry, there's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told if you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Last night, Terry McAuliffe kicked it off.
The 44th Quadrennial National Convention of the Democratic Party will now come to order.
Well, there it went. And, you know, here it goes. It's continuing. We'll be reporting on this as time goes on. In the meantime, the rest of the world is continuing as well. Although I do want to get back to some of this coverage of this thing. I think it's just fascinating. What is going on, how it's being spun, what the stories are that's being told. In particular, the story that's being told. One of the things about the media is that there is this need, I guess. I don't have a word for it. Beyond, almost an obsessive need to have a storyline. There has to be a story. in the context of the news, you know, and so the people get characterized and pigeonholed and like that. And the storylines, of course, are vulnerable to spinning, as it were. So we find on, for example, CNN, their senior analyst, Bill Schneider. You ever seen this guy on CNN? He's on Judy Woodruff's Inside Politics in the afternoon. It's on after I get off the air, so I watch it from time to time. And, you know, he looks like... I was going to say he kind of looks like, you know, your friendly grandfather. He looks more like the guy who owns the candy store or the hardware store. You know, the kind of Mr. Whipple, only not quite so weird. You know, he's kind of a nice old guy who I keep calling him old. He's probably only 10 years older than I am. But in any case... He's kind of gray and balding, and Judy, this is how it is. And he presents himself as an unbiased commentator. He's the one who's going to tell you what's really true. He's going to let you know what's really going on here on CNN, where he's the senior analyst. Turns out, he's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. The American Enterprise Institute is one of the more toxic of the corporate-funded right-wing think tanks in America that's out there putting the... Well, we've had, on several occasions on this program, people from AIE come on and debate various issues. You know, they were gung-ho for the Iraq War. They're in favor of privatizing Social Security. And on it goes. If it's good for big corporations, the AIE is generally all in favor of it. If it's good for the average American, well, I don't think that's their criteria. They may say, I'm sure that they would say differently. But in any case, here's Bill Schneider on CNN, the guy who is actually, you know, and CNN will not tell you this, he's a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. But on CNN, he's the senior political analyst. And as Media Matters pointed out this morning, the first day of the Democratic National Convention saw many in the media pushing a misleading storyline. And here's the key. This must have been the talking point of the day, probably coming out of the office of one of the producers at Faux News, or Ed Gillespie, former Enron lobbyist, fired from Enron, from his $700,000 a year job by Enron, and then, of course, hired by the Republican National Committee to head up their efforts. Or, Roger Ailes. Who knows where this originated, but apparently the talking point of the day, or of the evening last night, the afternoon and evening, was... out of the mainstream. These four words, this phrase, was apparently the talking point. Bill Schneider starts out. He says on CNN yesterday, a liberal consensus prevails among the Democratic delegates in Boston. Three-quarters endorse abortion on demand. Well, it turns out, when you actually look at what was said by whom, that it wasn't quite that way at all. The poll Schneider was referring to, Media Matters points out, that showed that 75% of delegates said the statement, quote, abortion should be generally available to those who want it, end quote, comes closer to their view, but their only other choices were a little different. Here are the questions. Feel free to take this test. One, abortion should be generally available to those who want it. Two, abortion should be available but under stricter limits than it is now. Keep in mind right now, if the baby is viable, if the baby could be born premature and live, you can't have an abortion, by and large. And number three, well, not by and large, it's, you know, we don't... unless the mother's going to die if nothing happens. Number three, abortion should not be permitted. So number one, should it be like it is now? Number two, should we have stricter limits than we have now? Number three, should we ban it outright? 75% of the people at the Democratic National Convention chose number one, keep it as it is. And Schneider says, you know, This is endorsing abortion. No, what they're saying is that they don't want any more restrictions. It's a negative choice, not a positive choice. It's so we hear, out of the mainstream. Okay, number one, Bob Novak. He's talking about Al Gore and Senator Hillary Clinton is out of the mainstream, accusing Gore of, quote, rants where he's screaming and yelling, end quote, calling Clinton, quote, a mean lady, end quote, and referring to, quote, flesh-eating, end quote, convention delegates. Get this? Flesh-eating convention delegates. Fox News, well, you expect this from Fox News, I suppose. These first two are on CNN. Fox News anchor Greg Jarrett seemed to prompt his Republican guest, Craig Fuller, to call John Kerry and John Edwards liberal. And the guy didn't do it. So Jarrett, the anchor, right? The anchor is supposed to be the news reporter, supplies his own answer to his own question. He says, I thought you were going to name the two prominent Democratic groups that gave John Kerry the most liberal rating in the U.S. Senate. I think Edwards came in fourth. Well, first of all, that's not true. They weren't Democratic groups. It was the National Review, or the National Journal, excuse me. It's a magazine. What I would call a conservative magazine. And secondly, those ratings were not based on their career votes. Those ratings were based on about an 8-month window, on this very narrow little window, where they were looking at the voting records of these two guys. And when you look at, overall, they're really, Edwards is more conservative than the majority of Democrats in the Senate, and Kerry's pretty much right in the middle, which frankly dismays me. I'd rather see somebody even more liberal, but, anyway, Fox News, it's all about the spin. It's all about the spin. And our mislead for the day, this is from the Daily Misleader, www.misleader.org. Bush Liz misleads on Homeland Security effort. Now, keep in mind the context of this. I'd like to bring this back around to Bill Clinton's speech last night. Bill Clinton started out his speech saying, when I was president, I'm paraphrasing here. I don't have the speech right in front of you. When I was president, the Republicans were pretty hard on me. He says, but once he left the presidency and started making money, they suddenly became his friend. Clinton, of course, is making millions a year now between speeches and best-selling books and whatnot. It's probably doing the same thing that George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan did when they got out. Jimmy Carter, I think, is the only president who hasn't done this in recent memory. I don't know about Nixon or Johnson, but Reagan really started this thing of, you leave the presidency and you get be on somebody's board of directors or give a speech. Reverend Moon had him giving speeches. And of course, he had George H.W. Bush giving more speeches, but for big bucks, of course. So anyhow, Clinton, no doubt, is doing the same thing. And Clinton says, now that I'm making all this money, these guys are my friends. They want to give me tax cuts. And I'm sure the Bush tax cuts have benefited Bill Clinton to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars, just like they did Dick Cheney, just like they did George W. Bush, just like they did Condoleezza Rice, just like they did Don Rumsfeld, just like they did Jon Snow, and just like they did Colin Powell, who was a former director of Time Warner AOL, whose son now is head of the FCC. And on it goes. And so he says, they've given me money. He says, I thought that was a pretty good idea until I realized who was actually paying for it. And he points out at the audience and says, and it's you. So anyhow, in the context of the fact that the Republicans can certainly find enough money to put hundreds of thousands of dollars in tax cuts. In the case of somebody like Warren Buffett, millions of dollars in tax cuts in the pockets and the family that owns Walmart, the Walton family, millions of dollars in tax cuts. in the pockets of the very wealthiest in America. Say, you earn your living sitting on your butt waiting for the dividend checks to arrive in the mail? Well, gee, you don't have to pay payroll taxes like the guy who's out there paving the road. Nope, you don't have to pay them at all. And in fact, we're going to cap your income tax at 15%. And if George gets elected again, he's going to make it zero. I kid you not, this was the last tax cut. Used to be if you made your money by investing money in the cash that came back, you put in the bank, you had to pay income tax at the regular rate. But ever since George gave his gift to the investor class last time, you only pay 15%. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we all had, you know, a couple million bucks sitting in the bank, we could just sit around 15, except then nobody would pay enough taxes to get anything done. Sorry. Somebody has to pay for the cost of government. George W. just decided it would be you and me and not multimillionaires like Rush Limbaugh and him. So anyhow, in the context of that, in a speech before the Urban Institute last Friday, President Bush said that his administration, quote, is trying to do everything we can to protect our homeland, end quote. But the reality is that the Bush administration has underfunded critical domestic security programs and failed to address key vulnerabilities. The Coast Guard, for example, said it needed $8.8 billion over the next 11 years and $1.5 billion in immediate funding to secure the nation's ports against terrorist attacks. How much out of that $1.5 billion of immediate funding they need did George Bush give them? $46 million. That's $0.046 billion. Less than one-tenth of what they said they had to have on port security. $46 million when they said they needed $1.5 billion immediately and $8.8 billion overall. Sorry, George says, we can't afford to protect our ports. We got to be sure that we can give tax cuts to multimillionaires. Tom Hartman, 20 minutes after the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates block out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
I'm sorry. There's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told if you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate, nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about The Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Do the Republicans or the Democrats have a clear vision for America that actually includes democracy, fairness, and justice? Do the Greens or the Progressives? How can we create a shared vision of the kind of future we want for our children? This is Tom Hartman, and I'll be exploring these and many other issues with guests from a wide variety of viewpoints, as well as taking your calls.
The Tom Hartman Show, 12 p.m. till 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
In the foreword to Tom Hartman's book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, renowned author Joseph Chilton Pierce writes,
"To discover brilliant, innovative, creative, and original thinking is one of life's rare privileges. To discover that such a thinker has focused on the most critical of all issues facing our species is encouraging. Because The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight is a seminal work, offering a viewpoint original yet ancient, I see our situation today in a new light. And because of the scope and depth of this work, I find it inspiring as well as disturbing. I rather exhausted superlative in praise of Tom Hartman's book, The Prophet's Way, which I rightly called the most important book I've ever read. But now I find this sequel calling for equal praise, since the issue here addresses the whole of our species, and indeed all species."
The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late by Tom Hartman, in bookstores everywhere.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Now, doesn't this just sound a little odd? I mean, you know, you think about it, and it's like, you know, here we have the ability to run up $7 trillion debt, $500 billion deficit, $300 million trade deficit. I mean, you know, just run the country into the ground. Huge tax cuts for the rich. But we can't protect our ports. But, by the way, look out. The terrorists are coming. And, by the way, if they attack, it's because they like John Kerry. Be sure that if the terrorists do attack us, that you remember that and vote for George Bush. Or maybe we just shouldn't even have elections. In the speech before the Urban Institute last Friday, George Bush says his administration is trying to do everything we can to protect our homeland. William Milner, however, the executive director of the American Public Transportation Association, said that the nation's public transit systems, that's subways, commuter rail, buses, ferries, light rail, the whole shooting match. This is the guy who's in charge of the whole thing, William Milner, in this administration. He says they need $6 billion. This was a couple of years ago. Said they needed $6 billion. Well, he's still saying it. For security improvements. If you take the amount that the Bush administration allocated to improve security on subways, commuter rail, buses, ferries, and light rail, the United States, the nation's public transit systems, the amount that they spent in 2001, the amount that they spent in 2002 after 9/11, the amount they spent in 2003 after 9/11, and the amount they've spent this year, keep in mind, the guy who's in charge of all this security for all these things says, "I need $6 billion, George, if I'm going to do this." How much do you think George W. has put into his budget and authorized? Instead of $6 billion, maybe $5 billion? No. Four? No, sorry. Three? No. How about $2 billion? One-third of what the guy says he needs? No, can't have that. How about $1 billion? One-sixth of what he says he needs? No, can't have that. How about $500 million? One-twelfth of what he says he needs? No, can't do that. How about $250 million? One-twenty-fourth of what he says he needs? Maybe we could protect the light rail system of New Orleans or something. No, sorry, can't do that. Got to give tax cuts to rich folks, you know. It's like we got to have our priorities. $115 million to fund public transit system security. $115 million when the guy in charge says, please give me $6 billion. Meanwhile, an estimated 2.5 million tons of uninspected cargo is loaded into the bellies of passenger planes every year. Now, the Bush administration has failed to designate a federal agency to monitor the cargo or track who is sending it. Not only have they not funded this, they haven't even said, you know, somebody ought to be looking in the bellies of the airplanes. That's a little beyond their thinking. Talk about a failure of imagination. How about a failure of thinking processes? The U.S. Transportation Security Administration says it does not have enough money or big enough machines to scan enough cargo fast enough without impeding commerce. And we certainly cannot impede commerce, even if it means, hey, how about some security? No, sorry, can't have the security. We got to get these Walmart products to market quick. Even if there might be a nuclear bomb in there being smuggled in from Indonesia. And this is the guy, George W., who thinks he is running as the... first it was the war president, then it was the peace president, now it's the security president. No, forget it. 29 minutes past the hour. For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
California once again leads the country in the number of employees who lost their jobs to mass layoff action. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that during the month of June, California reported 39,179 lost jobs in mass layoffs, bringing the state's total for 2004 to more than 210,000, 26% of the national total. The country as a whole saw nearly 135,000 workers lose their jobs in mass layoffs during the month of June. New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida also saw massive numbers of mass layoffs, with Ohio's total for the year growing to more than 39,000 and Florida's 45,000.
On Sunday, the AFL-CIO sponsored a labor forum for the Democratic National Convention. This reporter was in Boston speaking with Teamsters Union President James Hoffa about his support for Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry.
I'm convinced that he believes that the CAFTA is wrong. He's against it, and what we're going to do is to change those laws. We're going to have trade bills in the future. It's not like we're going to build a wall around that. We want to trade, but we want fair trade. We want people to buy our products, and right now it's a one-way street. They don't buy our products. They erect barriers. We can't sell in their markets, but they can come over here and sell to us. That's elementary, unfair. We're not going to have any more of that, and he agrees with that. When we try and ship products to China, there's all kinds of regulations, tariffs, and red tape that ties us up so we can't sell American products in China or India or even Japan. And that is wrong. And South Korea, too. And these one-sided agreements are basically handicapping the American worker. We can't sell good American products, good American cars in these markets. And that's what's got to be changed.
Here's a tip. When you use your credit card to tip your waitstaff, they may not be receiving the amount you intended. Many restaurants across the country deduct credit card processing fees from food servers' tips, but a current class action lawsuit filed on behalf of servers could affect the way restaurants do business. Two Denver attorneys are currently embattled with Houston restaurant chain Landry's Restaurants Incorporated, who are alleged to deduct at least 3% of the servers' tips to cover credit card processing. A win could result in millions of dollars of back wages for servers throughout the chain, but a loss could have repercussions for waitstaff throughout the country. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to conservative economist Paul Craig Roberts, U.S. job creation in June was focused around employment in the service sector, an area not heavy with competition from workers overseas. Yet Roberts also notes that real wages in America have not kept up with inflation over the past year, and take-home pay as a share of the national economy is at its lowest level since the federal government began tracking it in 1929.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do?
Oh, it's, what a great voice. They're really saying, I love you. And welcome back, 26 and a half minutes before the hour. And yeah, thank you for listening. It's looking like Michigan, Rachel, a listener, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG, drops me a note in email. Looking like Michigan has the potential to be another Florida this year, she says. News around here is whether or not Nader gets on the ballot. Apparently the Secretary of State is refusing, we've reported on this, he's got the Republican signatures. But then she adds, and this was an interesting one for me. She says, I think the bigger story, this being the local story, the Michigan story, Michigan perhaps being this year's Florida. She says, I think the bigger story is the fact that our Secretary of State, Terry Lynn Land, and our Attorney General, Mike Cox, have both been named chairs of Bush's reelection campaign. She says, I'm no expert, but that looks like a glaring conflict of interest to me. I don't hear anybody talking about that. Amen, Rachel. It was Catherine Harris in Florida. She was the Secretary of State in charge of purging felons from the vote list, knocking somewhere between 20 and 80,000 African Americans off the voter rolls, denying them the ability to vote when they had, there was no reason. They were legitimate voters. And that's how the Florida election got stolen. And this is not a secret. I mean, you know, Greg Palast wrote about this. BBC did a television special on this 4 weeks after the election, and everybody in Europe saw the thing. You can still see it. You can see the clip on Greg Palast's website, gregpalast.com. He wrote about it in his book, The Best Democracy America. The Best Democracy That You Can Buy, or the Best Democracy. The Best American Democracy Money Can Buy. That's it. The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Thank you. And picking up on it, Michael Moore put it in his book, Stupid White Men. And this is no secret. Catherine Harris, you know, she was paid off with a seat to run for Congress. And then the Republic, it became so obvious that she had stolen the vote. Her and Jeb together had criminally colluded to steal the vote in Florida, that the Republican Party asked her not to run again. Not to run again. It's just mind-boggling. Ellen Ratner's on the line. Hey, Ellen, in Boston. Ellen with the Talk Radio News Service and all that kind of... Are you there, Ellen?
Oh, I am here. Oh. And let me just tell you something. I just left 2 minutes ago two tables from me. Unbelievable discussion between Al Franken and Sean Hannity on the air.
Yeah.
We're actually going to be posting some sound for that. You'll get it. But first of all, Hannity goes after Franken about Kerry and the SUVs and saying his family member owned it. And Franken basically said, you're right, I should have said something. Then Franken says that he was not escorted out of Fox News. And Hannity says that he is going to go and get people to say under testimony, under oath, that he was escorted. It went on and on like this. It was honestly, I've been around radio a long time. one of the most amazing things I have ever seen.
Well, that's great. I hope there's an archive of it someplace, because I wouldn't want people to listen to my competitor's radio program right at this moment.
Well, they're not going to listen to your competitor's radio program. Besides, you're a lot better host. But,
bless you.
But when there's something pretty interesting in the industry, I got to say, and I have to credit Hannity for being willing to sit down with Franken and vice versa.
Yeah. Ellen, I have a question for you. There's a free speech zone outside the Fleet Center there in Boston.
You mean the one that nobody can get to because it's so far away?
Yeah.
That they won't allow anybody in it? The only way that it's being dealt with here is by bullhorn.
Well, here's the question I have for you, and I'd like you to look into this if you don't know the answer to it, because this, I think, is like one of the big issues. George Bush has been running these free speech zones, him and Dick Cheney, virtually from day one, wherever he gives a speech, and people all over America have been arrested for not going to the free speech zones and whatnot. And I'm wondering, I see this as a huge political blunder on the part of the Democrats if Terry McAuliffe of the Democrats had anything to do with putting that free speech zone out there. On the other hand, if the Secret Service or the governor...
I have the answer to your question.
Okay, or the governor of Massachusetts, who is a Republican, put the free speech zone out there and said, you've got to have this, then it would be an attempt by the Republicans to sabotage the Democrats and make them look like they're anti-free speech. Which was it?
I have a friend who's in the Secret Service, and I have these off-the-record dinners with him. And I asked him, I said, you know, you guys are totally protecting Bush. He said, I've got news for you. We did the same darn thing for Clinton. And when we talked about the free speech, the Secret Service, wink, 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 nod, does it for each party.
But, was I just, like, not paying attention? I mean, I don't remember any time that they set up cages blocks away from where Bill Clinton was speaking, and anybody with an anti-Clinton sign had to go there.
They certainly did it at the Democratic Convention in 2000. They had a protest zone, which was far away from anything else. It looked like a sort of caged basketball court.
Interesting.
So, yeah, no, this is nothing new. This is typical. Now, my brother, Michael Radner, from the Center for Constitutional Rights, has been litigating this free speech zone in front of the Republican convention in New York.
Yeah, we had him on the show last week.
I said, Michael, why bother with that? They're going to do that. Just go to find out every hotel, where the various delegations are going, and, you know, protest at each hotel. That's the best way to do it. There's nobody outside the Sheraton here, which is the DNC convention hotel.
Right.
And now, that's really where they ought to be.
Yeah, I don't disagree. You know, Ellen, I thought the one of the most important speeches given last night was by the Reverend David Alston, and it's gotten no coverage whatsoever. What's the buzz there? Did you hear this guy speak, the guy who was on the Swift boat with John Kerry?
Actually, I did not, but somebody fed me the sound. I wasn't there.
It just knocked me over.
And I thought it was excellent. And actually, Terry McAuliffe this morning, I interviewed him. He agreed that was the best speech of the evening.
Yeah,
a lot of people are saying Clinton's speech was... But the people don't pay attention to the early speeches. And, of course, the three networks that are only running 3 hours total for the convention. And even NPR, I mean, not NPR, whatever it is for television.
Yeah. PBS.
All they're doing is talking. They had Arianna Huffington and Robert Reich talking. Well, what good does that do?
Yeah, well, I saw this actually on PBS last night, because when I was watching MSNBC,
I know,
and they introduced
the other speeches.
Yeah, and they introduced the guy, and I said, wow, I want to hear that. And immediately they go to talk, you know, Chris Matthews starts talking to Joe Scarborough. And so I go to one of the other networks, and CNN, and they got talking heads, and finally on PBS. And of course, C-SPAN was running the thing straight, but they have very, very low listenership. And And this was right after Al Gore's speech. I mean, this was not outside of prime time. This was like, you know, just...
If it isn't a big name, they don't run it. And as you well know, some of the little people have more to say. And it's not as much total spin because the Democrats don't spend as much time just writing it.
Yeah. Well, it's unfortunate. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. What else is hot going on there right now, Ellen? What do you see as the top topics, as it were?
Well, I think what they're trying to do is to totally and completely motivate women. And I also know that ACT, America's Coming Together, is doing whatever they can to raise money in chunks of $50,000 to $100,000 to get those 527 ads up.
Yeah.
37, I think it's 527. And so what you're doing is you're seeing these sort of alternative, this is the first time, and I've been to many of these conventions, where you see the alternative events have better turnout with also more people. I'm talking about the alternative fundraisers than the actual Democratic National Committee, because they're now limited to $25,000 a person.
Yeah. Now, in the Boston Globe, I understand today, there's a full-page ad by Ramsey Clark, the former Attorney General of the United States, saying, hey, it's time to impeach George Bush for high crimes and misdemeanors, and he lays them out.
It was a great ad, and actually I was going to bring it up, but I thought you'd probably, I try and do stuff you're not already talking about.
Well, I haven't gotten to it yet. Tell us about what's the response, you know, on the ground there. How are people reacting to this thing?
The problem, of course, the Democratic Party has the same issue from the left that the Republican Party is the right. They kind of need them, but they would like to pretend they don't exist.
Well, hang on just a second. I mean, that's conventional wisdom, but the reality is that the landslide elections of the 20th century, where the Democrats won in huge landslides, were when Lyndon Johnson said that civil rights and the
that's
elimination
right.
of poverty
took a stand.
And FDR.
If Kerry loses at the election, it's going to be from the types like, I don't know about you, but the types from me who get totally disgusted. I'm a talk show host, so I always vote. But who get in the booth and say, I cannot vote for this guy. I'm going to vote green.
Yeah.
And you're right. If Kerry does not come out on the edge and excite people, forget it, and excite people who are in the more liberal wing of the party.
Yeah, I mean, every time a Democrat has run in the 20th century, I mean, you know, in the last 100 years, every time a Democrat has run as essentially the centrist candidate and won, it's been a squeaker. Jack Kennedy won by 100,000 votes, you know, as, you know, he was going to be the out Cold War warrior Richard Nixon. Jimmy Carter won on a squeaker, and that was largely because people thought Gerry Ford, you know, had been, you know, he'd pardoned Nixon, and they were still upset about Watergate. And these kind of centrist candidates, I really think that if Kerry were to say, hey, you know, I am a Democrat in the tradition of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and let's talk about minimum wage. Let's talk about, you know, rolling back Taft-Hartley in 1947, you know, that was passed over the veto of Harry Truman. Let's talk about, you know, when Ronald Reagan came into office, 25% of America was unionized. 50% of Americans had the kind of job where one person could raise a family, put kids through school, and still have a retirement. Now it's 8%. You know, why don't the Democrats talk about this stuff?
Good question. I just want, I don't know how much time we have.
Well,
I do want to say that, of course, they're supporting Obama, not exactly a liberal today, but he is an African-American candidate. The two speeches I would be very interested in watching tonight are James Forbes. He's a senior minister of the Riverside Church. I think he will maybe be as fiery as that last reverend. Mm-hmm. And also tonight, you're going to be hearing from Ronald Reagan, as son, Ronnie Reagan, on stem cell. And both of those are worth watching tonight.
Okay. I'll keep an eye out for him. Ellen, thanks so much for calling in with the daily update, feedback, information of, you know, what's going on there. I do appreciate it. Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service, our Washington correspondent. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Have a great afternoon. Take good care of yourself. And moving along, this speech by David Alston is just awesome. I'm gonna get the audio for that and share it with you, because it's just today we will have it on here, probably in the next hour. But anyhow, here, so the jobless recovery. Oh, Michigan, this is what we were talking about. I remember now. What's going to happen to Michigan? Is it possible that Michigan is going to go away? I mean, that it's going to melt down the way that Florida did, electorally, right, politically. Now, Rachel, who had sent me this note that I was sharing with you from Grand Rapids, she says, I was looking for a positive thing to do about this. What a wonderful, you know, I am so pleased when people say, I see a problem and I want to find a solution. I'm going to work for the solution. I'm going to participate in the process. I'm going to get involved. It makes me absolutely crazy when I read these things. But, well, I probably should have even just, you know, taken Ellen up on it, her comment, you know, that people, Democrats, get into the voting booth and they say, well, you know, this guy isn't progressive enough for me, or liberal enough, or whatever, or he's too conservative, and so I'm going to vote green. Why not infiltrate the Democratic Party? Why not participate in the process? Why not become an activist? Why not jump in with both feet and help make change happen in America? Well, that's what Rachel's doing. And God bless her. I am so impressed. She says, I was looking for a positive thing to do about this, and I've recently signed up as a volunteer for election protection through People for the American Way. Election protection is this cadre of folks who are going to distribute voter bills of rights and possibly work as poll workers or monitors. People for the American Way, you can find out about it at their website, pfaw.org. Check under civic participation, Rachel tells me, and you can find more information there. And I've been there. You can, and it is. Paul Krugman today in the New York Times raises a startling story, as it were, a startling scenario, along the lines of what Rachel had emailed me about, this whole thing about what's going to happen with the elections. Not just in Michigan, but all over the country. Paul Krugman's column, it's called Fear of Fraud. It starts out, I'll just quote from the article. He says, it's election night, and early returns suggest trouble for the incumbent. Then, mysteriously, the vote count stops, and observers from the Challengers campaign see employees of a voting machine company, one of them wearing a badge that identifies him as a county official, typing instructions at computers with access to the vote tabulating software. When the count resumes, the incumbent pulls ahead. The challenger demands an investigation, but there are no ballots to recount. And election officials, allied with the incumbent, refused to release data that could shed light on whether there was tampering with the electronic records. This, of course, is everyone's worst nightmare for 2004, but Paul Krugman adds, this is not a paranoid fantasy. It's a true account of a recent election in Riverside County, California, reported by Andrew Gumbel of the British newspaper The Independent. Mr. Gumbel's full-length report, printed in Los Angeles City Beat, makes hair-raising reading, not just because it reinforces concerns about touchscreen voting, but because it also shows how easily officials can stonewall after a suspect election. What will happen in 2004? Well, you can participate. You can be a voter watcher. Go for People for the American Way and check it out.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of enlightened teachers led by Maitreya, the world teacher, is here to inspire a new approach based on the principle of sharing. With their guidance, we can transform the world and create a peaceful future for all. For a free audio CD of an extraordinary lecture by Benjamin Krem on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
Tom Hartman will be speaking out in Santa Fe, New Mexico with We the People, a call to take back America, a Friday evening talk August 27th at the Santa Fe Armory for the Arts, to be followed by a Saturday, August 28th workshop called Waking Up to Personal and Global Transformation. Tom Hartman brings his wit, wisdom, and intelligence to Santa Fe the weekend of August 27th and 28th. Tom Hartman will discuss with us how America faces its greatest threat since a civil war. And Tom Hartman will look at how Western thinking, legends, and myths have caused global problems and endangered democracy and what we can do about it. To get your tickets and more information, call 505-988-2223 in Santa Fe. That's 505-988-2223 or visit greatmystery.org. Tickets for Tom Hartman are also available at Collected Works Bookstore in Santa Fe.
Children who get lots of exercise risk poor health if they breathe polluted air. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Couch potatoes are in some ways healthier than kids who play soccer, run, or participate in other outdoor sports if they live in areas with high levels of air pollution. Kent Bransford is a medical doctor and a member of Physicians for Social Responsibility, an advocacy group. He cites a recent study of children living in Southern California.
What they did is take children all growing up in the same bad air area, and then they divided them into two groups. One group, very active, playing outside like we probably want our kids to do. So if they were in three or more sports during the year, they were in the active group. And then the other half of the kids were living in the same area but more sedentary. So inside, playing with their Game Boys and PlayStations, etc.
Bransford says the results were surprising.
What was very worrisome is that the children that were outside, active, playing, breathing a lot of air, which children do more so for their body weight than adults, they had about a threefold increase risk of developing asthma compared to the kids who were not as active.
Another recent study looked at California college freshmen. It focused on students who had similar activity levels but compared where they grew up. Bransford says those from Southern California, where smog levels are highest, had more lung disorders than kids from Northern California, where the air is better.
Those college freshmen had decreased lung function studies at age 18, purely related on where they grew up and the air they breathe.
Bransford says air pollution can cause health problems that might last a lifetime. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
I see trees of green, red roses too.
And welcome back. Yeah, it is a beautiful world. It's actually raining here today in the People's Republic of Vermont. But it's still a marvelous day. Every day you wake up breathing is a marvelous day, right? 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Diane in Grand Rapids is on the line. Hey, Diane, how are you? What's up?
Hi, fine. I don't have a television, and I listen to NPR.
Mm-hmm.
And last night I was listening, and they started their coverage at 10 o'clock, and the first thing that was on, numero uno on NPR, my news outlet, was the speech from the Good Reverend.
Oh, great.
So that was like the first thing. It was electrifying. It was unbelievable, and that's what they started with.
Yeah,
so
he
I want to tell you, it's got to be like millions of people like me that listen to NPR that heard that.
Yeah, he just did. Here's just a little bit of, so you get a sense of his voice.
I know him from a small boat in Vietnam where we fought and bled together serving our country. There were six of us aboard PCF 94.
That's Reverend David Alston, and it's just a marvelous speech, and I thought it was the most important speech of the evening, frankly, because it was the only one that really gave an insight into the character of the guy who's running for President of the United States.
Well, I also thought that what really went well with it was when Clinton said, you know, I and the man in the White House and the Vice President did not do what John Kerry did and did not say, send me. And even though John Kerry was from a privileged background and could have avoided the war, he didn't. And I thought that really went with the Reverend's speech as sort of a bookend to show what those weenies didn't do.
Yeah, it was very powerful. Here's a very short clip.
I am a man of faith, and I did not come here tonight to glorify what we did. I came here to share my personal knowledge of a young naval officer who rose to the challenges and responsibilities of leadership and who has always shown the courage to speak truth to power.
I thought that was an amazing statement, too. It's just well said.
Oh, right. And when he says that that's the reason he made it back was because of John Kerry.
Yeah, that John Kerry it saved his life. It's remarkable. Diane, thanks so much for the call.
Great.
It's great to hear from you. Thanks for listening to us there on WTKG as well. And just to wrap up this fear of fraud thing, I just want to lay this one last point down from Paul Krugman. Spokesman for Governor Jeb Bush says they're going to do their elections with machines that don't have ballots or receipts this year. Thank you very much. Don't worry. Everything's going to be fine. Yeah. Tom Hartman here, the True People's Radio. You're in the Truth Arena.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide. And you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hart.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
California once again leads the country in the number of employees who lost their jobs to mass layoff action. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that during the month of June, California reported 39,179 lost jobs in mass layoffs, bringing the state's total for 2004 to more than 210,000, 26% of the national total. The country as a whole saw nearly 135,000 workers lose their jobs in mass layoffs during the month of June. New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida also saw massive numbers of mass layoffs, with Ohio's total for the year growing to more than 39,000 and Florida's 45,000.
On Sunday, the AFL-CIO sponsored a labor forum for the Democratic National Convention. This reporter was in Boston speaking with Teamsters Union President James Hoffa about his support for Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry.
I'm convinced that he believes that the CAFTA is wrong. He's against it, and what we're going to do is to change those laws. We're going to have trade bills in the future. It's not like we're going to build a wall around that. We want to trade, but we want fair trade. We want people to buy our products, and right now it's a one-way street. They don't buy our products. They erect barriers. We can't sell in their markets, but they can come over here and sell to us. That's elementary, unfair. We're not going to have any more of that. He agrees with that. When we try and ship products to China, there's all kinds of regulations, tariffs, and red tape that ties us up so we can't sell American products in China or India or even Japan. And that is wrong, and South Korea too. And these one-sided agreements are basically handicapping the American worker. We can't sell good American products, good American cars in these markets. And that's what's got to be changed.
Here's a tip. When you use your credit card to tip your waitstaff, they may not be receiving the amount you intended. Many restaurants across the country deduct credit card processing fees from food service tips, but a current class action lawsuit filed on behalf of servers could affect the way restaurants do business. Two Denver attorneys are currently embattled with Houston restaurant chain Landry's Restaurants Incorporated, who are alleged to deduct at least 3% of the servers' tips to cover credit card processing. A win could result in millions of dollars of back wages for servers throughout the chain, but a loss could have repercussions for waitstaff throughout the country. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to conservative economist Paul Craig Roberts, U.S. job creation in June was focused around employment in the service sector, an area not heavy with competition from workers overseas. Yet Roberts also notes that real wages in America have not kept up with inflation over the past year, and take-home pay as a share of the national economy is at its lowest level since the federal government began tracking it in 1929.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You put in 30 years at the company. You got good pay, health care. Then they send you a job overseas. And under George Bush, the company actually gets a tax break for doing it. Now, Bush says we're in recovery. Then after a year, you finally land another job, and you wonder, is this what you worked your whole life for? We're not being led. We're being misled.
After years of studious analysis and sober reflection, I've come to this measured conclusion about the Bushites. These people are nuts. When I presented this blunt conclusion in my latest book, Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush, several peers of establishment punditry said, "Oh, Hightower, surely you don't mean nuts. Robust corporatists, yes. Even exuberant empire builders for their conservative worldview. But surely Bush, Cheney, Ashcroft, Rumsfeld and company are not, you know, extremists who would try to superimpose their own Orwellian, Strangelovian, Irandian, Jerry Falwellian ideology over America's democratic ideals and institutions, right? Wrong. They're insane. Loopy zealots fueled by their own extremist fumes to implement their plutocratic, autocratic, imperialistic vision of America. And it's time we stop beating around the bush about it. From a stolen election in Florida to elitist tax giveaways for the rich, from a war of lies in Iraq to a culture of repression in the homeland, the Bushites are willing to break all the rules, laws, and notions of public trust to have their way and remake America in their corporatist image. The latest example of this is their legal maneuvering to, get this, give them the executive power to postpone this fall's presidential elections. I know, you're thinking, come on, Hightower, even they're not that nutty. But yes, they are. Homeland Czar Tom Ridge has asked legal schemers to produce a doomsday scenario under which the national election could be put off in the event of, say, a code red terrorist alert issued by, who else, Ridge's own department. We are considering what steps need to be taken to secure the election, said a Homeland spokesman. This is Jim Hightower saying, not even in the Civil War or in the madness of the McCarthyism scare was it even suggested by top officials that elections be suspended. That's how nutty the Bushites are. I'm Jim Hightower, and I've approved this message.
Jim Hightower is not running for office, but he is back this campaign season with an important word about the regime of King George W.
Let's stop beating around the bush. These people are nuts.
Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush is Hightower's hilarious new best-selling book, offering you unvarnished facts, insight, and humor to get you through this year's political spin cycle. Buy Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush today and make politics fun again. Available at bookstores everywhere and on the web at jimhightower.com. Buy it today.
America is a country of entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner, you're helping shoulder the lion's share of the U.S. economy. You can lighten that load a little at Sam's Club. When you shop at Sam's Club, you get everyday low costs on products you need every day. After all, while you may be carrying around the weight of the American economy, you shouldn't have to do all the heavy lifting by yourself. Join the club. Sam's Club. We are in business for small business.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, and beaming around the planet on radiopower.org on the internet. And as I believe I said, on radio stations in California, North Carolina, what happened? What do you know about history? Is it possible that what we think we know about history is like, you just don't even know it? I mean, you don't, sort of like, you know, everything you know is wrong. Well, Dennis Lloyd Johnson has written a marvelous little book called The Big Chill, and it's part of a series of very small, accessible, readable books, and I don't mean small in a negative sense. I think it is great because nobody has time to read anymore, and this is a 100-page book, and it's just a marvelous little marvelous thing that Melville House Publishing has come out with. And it's the great unreported story of the Bush inauguration protest. Dennis Lloyd Johnson, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. My recollection of George Bush's inauguration day, first of all, I think it's, correct me if I'm wrong, but my recollection is that it was a rainy day. It was a kind of a gray and miserable day, wasn't it?
It was not only rainy, it was freezing.
Yeah.
We were getting pelted there with hail more often than not. It was really Arctic temperatures.
Which is, you know, it's funny. I haven't paid attention to all of the other presidential inauguration days, but in her book, October Surprise, Barbara Honegger, who was a member of the Reagan administration, and, you know, lays out the thing of George Bush cutting a deal with the Iranians and, you know, to hold the hostages so Carter would lose the election. She talks about how at the moment that it was the day that Reagan was inaugurated, it was sort of a cloudy day, but the sun kept breaking out. And just as Reagan stepped up to put his hand on the Bible, the sun broke out and it got warm, and it was just this, you know, they took it as an omen. And so,
morning in America.
Yeah, and so maybe this, maybe there is something to this omen business. Although Reagan's morning in America ended up kind of biting us in the behind.
M O U R N, I think.
Yeah, yeah. But in any case, Bush comes to power in a cold rainstorm and hailstorm, and yet my recollection is that I saw a picture of him walking down the street, smiling and waving. Or, you know, being, you know, there is this kind of very positive public thing. And in your book, you say that photo that I and probably every other American who, you know, looked at the newspapers those days, you know, walking in the parade crowd, waving to the crowd, that this is not really what happened. I mean, this kind of strikes me as the did Neil Armstrong really walk on the moon?
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's no question about it. It was a staged photo, and some places did report it as such, but usually in very small print at the jump end of the article.
Well, now, I remember Jimmy Carter, when he was inaugurated, he actually walked, the same as Thomas Jefferson. Adams had this huge kind of coronation, you know, and he came in these carriages and the whole hoop-de-doop, and Jefferson said, no, I'm going to walk to the White House for this thing, or walk to Congress for this thing. And and Jimmy Carter imitated that. He thought that was cool, and he did the same thing.
Yeah.
And I remember watching
that.
He walked
all the way from the Capitol to the White House.
Yeah, and I remember watching that live on television. So what's the reality of the story of what happened with George W.?
Well, the reality is that George W. was the first president since Carter who didn't walk the parade route. What he did, it would have been insanity for him to walk the parade route, because the parade route was just lined with a really, really vehement crowd.
An ugly crowd.
It was
an angry crowd.
It was a really large, intensely angry crowd, and his limousine pelted with refuse and eggs and soda bottles and the like, and it went through at high speed. And when they got to the end of the parade route, there was an area around the White House that is cordoned off, and it was a really high security area, chained in, chain link fence, lots of steel barricades, lots of stone barricades, lots of security forces, and the only people that are in there are family and friends and appointees and high-level donors. And when he got in there, well, yeah, he did get out of the car, and an AP photographer took a photo, and he got back in the car. By most accounts, he was out of the car for about 20 seconds and then went on to the White House party.
And that
it was actually staged.
And that was the picture that was shown around the world.
That was the picture that the New York Times and Newsweek magazine and tons of other places ran and mislabeled, actually misreported, gave out the misinformation that he was walking the parade route. But he did not walk the parade route.
Now, the police say there were 10,000 folks there. The folks who were there claim it was 500,000. What's real here? You were there.
I was there, and all I can tell you is that I was standing on the parade route at 14th and K. At 14th and Pennsylvania. And as far as you could see, and I'm not just talking left or right, but front and back, there were people, and they were protesting the fact that this man had somehow assumed the presidency.
Yeah, illegitimately.
So I can't really give you. I'm not good at estimating crowds. I can tell you there had to be 10,000 people standing within my vision, and by all reports there were tens of thousands of people kept away from the parade route by various police tactics. I couldn't see the whole crowd, so I don't know who's right. It certainly was more than the 10,000 that they put it at. CNN put it at 20,000. It may not have been the 500,000 the organizers claim, but it was sure a lot of people.
Yeah. Now, these organizers, in the back of your book, there's a photograph of this. Heck, let me just flip to it here. And it says, you know, a black block, BLOC, protester. Mm-hmm. And this guy is flying through the air, apparently, with a backpack on into the crowd. What was the Black Bloc, and who? What was this group? What were they about?
Well, they're a very mysterious group of protesters who first came to fame in the Seattle riots against the WTO. And
that would have been in 96.
They are a group of people who they wear all black hoods, black face masks, black clothes, and they call themselves anarchists. And they basically are kind of an anti-police force, as far as I can tell. They seem to mean to protest and disrupt police tactics to prevent protests. And the picture, which is an amazing picture, comes from an event they staged whereby they had climbed a flagpole at the Navy Memorial, which is right on Pennsylvania Avenue along the parade route, and burned a little handheld American flag. And when the police came and surrounded the pole, The black guy who was up on the flagpole literally leapt off, as the picture shows him. He looks like Superman flying through the air, and landed on a bunch of his brothers over the back of the police. Just flew over their heads, landed in this group, pulled off his outfit, and disappeared in the crowd.
Amazing. Are these
just in a couple of places?
Now, are these the folks who were so widely reviled for doing acts of vandalism during the Seattle protests?
Well, they are blamed with a lot of vandalism. Seattle was anarchy. I think it was much more organized effort at the D.C. protests. These people are pretty organized.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing they did was that they held a rally at one of the parks in D.C. near the parade route. And when the police came to break that up, they form ranks and they charge the police. They actually look like they've practiced drilling.
It doesn't seem like a very good idea.
Well, in that case, it wasn't. As the front page of the Washington Post showed, they showed pictures that few others did, but there were some serious police beatings at Washington that went generally unreported. But there was a pretty good bit of violence, and the Black Bloc was involved with some of it.
Are they still around? Are they at Chicago or in Boston right now for the DNC?
Well, that I can't answer. There have been some groups that are taking their tactics up there, and they're actually some of them claim that there is no group, that it's just kind of this committee that shows up.
Sort of like this generation's
not a group.
Like this generation's version of the Weathermen.
pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, they've also shown up at WTO protests in Genoa and elsewhere in Europe. And,
yeah. Well, okay. The larger question. I don't want to focus on this one group. I think it's curious. You know, it's interesting. But why, if a half a million people or less, but if a lot of people showed up in Washington D.C., disrupted for the first time in history, as far as I can think of. I mean, literally in the first time of the 200 and at that point it would have been what 224 year history of the United States, disrupted the inauguration of a president of the United States. Why was not the videotape of these hundreds of thousands of people lining the parade route and throwing eggs at the president's car and the president's car running through there at high speed like a rabbit running the gauntlet there, to mix metaphors badly, why wasn't that shown?
Well,
what happened with that?
First of all, you know, when you talk about this stuff, you're a conspiracist, right?
But you know, in your book, what I read in your book, there was actually like this flatbed truck with the press on it, and they were going down the road, but the press stopped taking pictures because they were...
Yeah.
Because I'll let you tell the story.
Well, they were very nervous. What they discovered is that the people are as angry at the press as they are at their politicians, and they've become kind of synonymous, really. But
footage
of it, and Michael Moore showed it in his movie. It's the first time I got to see it. But there is footage of it. They just didn't show it. There's plenty of press there that day. But my theory is that it's a complex answer. The people did shout at the police at the press and scream shame at them as vociferously as they did at the president. And I think that animosity is returned. But generally, I think part of the problem is that things are different. You know, it isn't Woodward and Bernstein of old. It isn't scruffy, hungry reporters reporting the truth. Now those reporters are often reporting about people that are their equals, their peers.
Yeah. They're multimillionaires reporting on multimillionaires, powerful people reporting on powerful people.
Sure, Bob Woodward's a lot more powerful and a lot richer than 99% of the people he interviews.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, I think at the time there was a real paternal attitude in the press. That's the big difference to me from when I was a kid in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And the press seemed to have an attitude at the time that they had to prevent panic, that they had to tell everybody everything's going to be okay. And in fact, a week after the inaugural, the New York Times ran a front page article, the first sentence of which said it was the smoothest transition in American presidential history.
Which was nonsense. That's great. We're out of time here, but let me just wrap this up for our listeners. The book is The Big Chill. Dennis Lloyd-Johnson is the author. You can find it in bookstores near you, order it on the internet. And it's marvelous. It's a great read. Dennis, thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. 20 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman program. Stick around.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog. Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack. And automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
I'm sorry. There's nothing more we can do. No one wants to hear those devastating words from a doctor. But that's what millions of Americans suffering from diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and diabetes will be told if you vote for Ralph Nader. Americans who voted for Nader put Bush in the White House in 2000. As president, George W. put the brakes on embryonic stem cell research, which could lead to revolutionary new treatments and cures. John Kerry vows to push this research forward. George W. Bush is still taking orders from the religious right. He wants to stifle stem cell research. This time, don't help him. Don't vote for Ralph. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate nor any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The latest figures from the Federal Pension Benefit Guaranty Corporation say the number of underfunded pension plans dropped last year by 9%. About 1,050 pensions are collectively short some $279 billion, yet the report doesn't paint a complete picture. It only covers pension funds, which are $50 million or more in the red, and conveniently overlooks the massive underfunding that's taken place since 1999.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Come together right now over me.
Welcome back. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Right. Well, it's Ted Kennedy tonight. I'm going to be speaking at the Democratic National Convention. And before I get to that, actually, I wanted to just share a little bit of Reverend David Alston with you. I think this was the most important speech that was given last night because it was the only speech that was given last night that spoke to the, well, many of them talked, you know, somewhat about the character of John Kerry. But here's a guy, you know, people, some people, particularly great leaders, have gone through transformational experiences in their young years. World War I, Jack Kennedy, PT-109. And they go through these extraordinary, difficult, challenging, life-changing experiences and come out, you know, with something that's a source of strength and a resource for them for the rest of their lives. And that's what happened to John Kerry in Vietnam. Here's the Reverend David Alston talking about his experience. Well, I'll just let him make the introduction.
I know him from a small boat in Vietnam where we fought and bled together serving our country. There were six of us aboard PCF 94, a 50-foot twin-engine craft known as a swift boat. We all came from different walks of life, but all of us, including our skipper, John Kerry, volunteered for combat duty, and combat we got. We usually patrol the narrow waterways of the Mekong Delta, flanked on both sides by thick jungle. As our crewmate Gene Thorson put it, we were a traveling bullseye, and we often came under sudden attack from the enemy hidden in the shadows. Machine gun fire, rocket-propelled grenades, it all came fast and furious, and Lieutenant Kerry had to make quick life or death decisions for the entire boat.
And in order to do that and about that, David Alston continues.
Once he even directed the helmsman to beach the boat right into the teeth of an ambush and pursue the attackers into the jungle on foot. In the toughest of situations, Lieutenant Carey showed judgment, loyalty, and courage. Even wounded, confronting sights no man should ever have to see, he never lost his cool. And when the shooting stopped, he was always there, too, with a caring hand on my shoulder, asking, Gunner, are you okay?
Yeah. Remarkable insight into the character and nature of John Kerry. I think this is David Alston, Reverend David Alston, last night at the DNC, the Democratic National Convention. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Chris in New Mexico is on the line. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, reading one of your books, it becomes clear that George W. Bush does not have attention deficit disorder. He just has simple deficit disorder, and attention has nothing to do with it.
Actually, I think he does, but in any case, it's...
I agree. Perusing the right-wing talk shows this morning and last night, as Sun Tzu said, you have to know your enemy. The lengths that the right wing is going, at least in talk radio, to avoid referencing Bill Clinton's address last night is completely fascinating. I guess they don't have any way to respond to that.
They don't have a rebuttal for the points he made. I mean, he basically laid out the right-wing agenda and how it's destroying America's middle class. Bang, 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 bang. And, yeah.
It was a masterful performance, and if you listen to Limbaugh or any of the rest of that witless ilk, it's all Theresa Carey. You know, when you call up and you ask, you know, is it worse telling a reporter to stick it or telling a United States senator to F-word yourself? Mm-hmm. Which is worse? And then it gets sputtery and bombastic, and they start yelling. I really think they're in a bad space.
They've got nothing but character assassination, Chris, because the conservative agenda for America is to destroy the middle class and give the wealth of the middle class to the wealthy. I mean, it's very, very, very straightforward. The thing that people don't get, and that conservatives understand, but the average American doesn't get, is that the middle class in America, the middle class in any country, is an artifice. The middle class is something that can only exist by government intervention in the marketplace. I'll explain that right after this break. Chris, thanks for the call, and thanks for bringing this up. Well-made point. 29 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about The Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
California once again leads the country in the number of employees who lost their jobs to mass layoff action. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that during the month of June, California reported 39,179 lost jobs in mass layoffs, bringing the state's total for 2004 to more than 210,000, 26% of the national total. The country as a whole saw nearly 135,000 workers lose their jobs in mass layoffs during the month of June. New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida also saw massive numbers of mass layoffs, with Ohio's total for the year growing to more than 39,000 and Florida's 45,000.
On Sunday, the AFL-CIO sponsored a labor forum for the Democratic National Convention. This reporter was in Boston speaking with Teamsters Union President James Hoffa about his support for Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry.
I'm convinced that he believes that the CAFTA is wrong. He's against it, and what we're going to do is to change those laws. We're going to have trade bills in the future. It's not like we're going to build a wall around that. We want to trade, but we want fair trade. We want people to buy our products, and right now it's a one-way street. They don't buy our products. They erect barriers. We can't sell in their markets, but they can come over here and sell to us. That's elementary, unfair. We're not going to have any more of that, and he agrees with that. When we try and ship products to China, there's all kinds of regulations, tariffs, and red tape that ties us up so we can't sell American products in China or India or even Japan. And that is wrong. And South Korea, too. And these one-sided agreements are basically handicapping the American worker. We can't sell good American products, good American cars in these markets. And that's what's got to be changed.
Here's a tip. When you use your credit card to tip your waitstaff, they may not be receiving the amount of credit card processing fees from food servers' tips, but a current class action lawsuit filed on behalf of servers could affect the way restaurants do business. Two Denver attorneys are currently embattled with Houston restaurant chain Landry's Restaurants Incorporated, who are alleged to deduct at least 3% of the servers' tips to cover credit card processing. A win could result in millions of dollars of back wages for servers throughout the chain, but a loss could have repercussions for waitstaff throughout the country. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. According to conservative economist Paul Craig Roberts, U.S. job creation in June was focused around employment in the service sector, an area not heavy with competition from workers overseas. Yet Roberts also notes that real wages in America have not kept up with inflation over the past year, and take-home pay as a share of the national economy is at its lowest level since the federal government began tracking it in 1929.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
So a new
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Ted Kennedy tonight is going to be speaking at the terrible liberal. Are you kidding? No, actually, Ted Kennedy. Yeah. Ted Kennedy, the man who is loved and hated by many. I would say probably Ted Kennedy and George Bush are opposite ends of the spectrum, but they both have the same quality in that they emotions from people. And frankly, I have to say that's something in both Kennedy and Bush that is a quality that I salute. I don't like Bush's, you know, the way that he demonstrates it. Certainly, I think it's destructive to democracy. It's dangerous to America. But, he's doing what either what he really and truly believes is best or what he's paid to do, or he's so clueless, he's just, you know, but whatever it may be. And Ted Kennedy has certainly, throughout his entire life, done, politically anyway, what he thought was the best thing. His personal life is another area. But in any case, he's going to be talking about health care in all probability tonight. And the timing on this is fascinating because today the Bush administration released 1,342 pages. Yeah, my point earlier was that, you know, people who don't arouse emotions tend not to be doing anything, right? So anyhow, the Bush administration today released 1,342 pages of proposed regulations for the final drug benefit, the prescription drug benefit, which is going to take effect in 2006. This is the Medicare thing. Remember the Medicare thing? Yes, we will help you pay for your drugs. No, you may not buy cheaper drugs.
You must buy the expensive drugs. And then we will take taxpayer money and pay for them. But not for all of them. There are catches. There are... It is absolutely bizarre. I mean, here's the reality. Starting in 2006, just a mind-boggling amount of money is going to be shifted to, not to seniors, but to the drug companies. See, this is the thing. Most people think that, George Bush is all upset. The Republicans are all in a tizzy because the Medicare bill is actually going to cost $100 billion. And it turns out that really that money is not going to go to you and me. It's going to go to the drug companies. Not only that, you've got big corporations, I mean like General Motors, went in and said, you know, we got a bunch of retirees who will qualify for this drug benefit. Right now we're paying for their drugs in our retirement programs. And if you pass this bill, we're inclined to just throw them off our pension program. I mean, why should we pay pension? Why should we pay drug benefits as part of our pension program, or health care at all, for that matter, if they qualify for Medicare, and Medicare is now offering drug benefits? And so why don't you give us some money to cover our costs of taking care of these retirees, at least, you know, and we'll take care of that generation. And so the Bush administration kicked in $89 billion over the next 10 years in corporate welfare. Direct transfers from the taxpayers to some of America's largest corporations, and then did not, N-O-T, capital letters, did not write into the legislation a requirement that these companies who are going to get the money continue to pay their retiree benefits. In other words, they can take the money and throw their retirees off their medical plans, and it just increases their bottom line. They just make more profits. You think I'm kidding? I'm not. This is just mind-boggling. So here are major contributors to President Bush, who aggressively lobbied for the bill's passage. For example, General Motors, whose executives have donated more than $110,000 personally to Bush's presidential campaign versus $9,000 to John Kerry, estimates that the new Medicare law will be worth $4.1 billion to the company. Another corporation whose executives, Xcel Energy, gave $22,000 to Bush, $500 to John Kerry. Expect to receive $64 million. GM gets $4.1 billion. But that's a pretty good deal, you know. Invest $110,000 in greasing George W. and you get $4.1 billion. And you get to throw all those nasty retirees off your pension rolls and increase your profits. Isn't America amazing? Now that sounded cynical. And that's the tragedy, because America really and truly is amazing. This is one of the finest nations in the history of the world. We started the whole thing. The whole idea of government of, by, and for we the people. Which gets me back to my point that I was making just before the break, that one of the things that Jefferson understood so clearly, and you read his letters and it just comes out so unambiguously, is that a middle class is essential to democracy. You must have a majority of the people who have the means to live. They can educate their children, they can be educated themselves. They don't worry about health, you know, they can pay their health care bills, they actually have enough money to retire on. They're paid a decent salary, and they have time left over. They have leisure time to pay attention to things like the governance of the nation, politics, in other words. And in Jefferson's day, and this is where Jefferson's vision wasn't altogether accurate when he looked out at the future. In Jefferson's day, there was a huge middle class. Jefferson was sort of at the top end of it, you could say, as were most of the founders. They weren't wealthy. The first millionaire in today's dollars, in the equivalent, the 1770s equivalent of today's dollars, the first person in the United States after the very, very rich left, after the 1776 Revolution. I mean, there were some very, very wealthy people in North America, and their wealth was tied to England. And they either fled to Canada or they went to England during and immediately after the Revolutionary War. But of the people who stayed, the first American millionaire happened in 1790. Wasn't Jefferson, wasn't Washington, wasn't any of those guys. John Hancock was the wealthiest person to sign the Declaration of Independence. He left no fortune. There is no Hancock Foundation. There is an insurance company. They simply borrowed his name. No relationship to the family. I mean, it's an okay thing that they did that. I'm not criticizing them. My point is just that none of the founders, the first American generation to be able to accumulate such wealth that they could have huge family foundations and dynasties, that they could live literally like kings, was the robber baron bunch in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900, 1910, 1920, in that era, that 50, 60-year span. And the reason why was because in the 1880s, Rockefeller, by and large, John D. Rockefeller, the main one, was able to play the states against each other. When Ohio said to him, "We are not going to let you behave in a way that destroys small entrepreneurial companies," which is what he was doing with his Standard Oil Trust. Because every state in the Union in the 1880s had laws against that. It was illegal to give money to politicians. It was called bribery and influencing. Lobbying was a felony. And you couldn't, as a business, a corporation could not own other corporations. A corporation could not dominate an industry. There were strict limits. They said, "You want to do business? Wonderful. You want to make money? Great. But don't do it in a way that prevents entrepreneurs, small business people, from rising up and building their own businesses. We're not going to allow it. If you're going to play the game of business, you have to play it in a way that benefits society as well as making you money. You can't do it in a way that makes you money and harms society." And when Ohio said to Rockefeller, "We're going to put you out of business, we're going to cancel your charter," because the individual states authorize the creation of a corporation. You want to start a corporation, you have to go to the Secretary of State's office. And Ohio said, "You're breaking the rules." And so John D. Rockefeller went out and he said, "Okay, what other state will take me?" And New Jersey said, "We'll change our rules if you'll come here." A few well-greased politicians. And then New York State said, "Well, we'll change our rules too." And this great competition broke out in the Northeast. It was called the chartermongering era. It lasted broadly from 1787 to around 1887 to around 1895. In all the states, virtually all the states of the Northeast, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine were not part of it, but the rest of the Northeast, New England states, changed their charter laws, their corporate laws, to allow this kind of behavior. And now all the states have. The rest of them picked it up by the 1920s. And what this led to was the destruction of the middle class. There was a middle class during Jefferson's era, and that middle class was based on land. There was lots and lots of free land because so many Native Americans, so many Indians had died from the diseases that Europeans brought over here, and the ones that hadn't died had been pushed off their land or killed. There was just a tremendous, a mind-boggling amount of free land. And so you could get your 80 acres, you could have a farm, you could produce your own food, you could have a surplus you could sell, and that produced a middle class, and the middle class was based on agriculture. And Jefferson thought that the agricultural middle class of America would last forever, and that was his mistake. But he understood correctly that without a middle class, you can't have a democracy. Not one that works anyway. One of the reasons why, when, in 1787, when the Constitution was presented to him, he said that there must be an amendment to it, a Bill of Rights, he said, that includes a ban on corporate monopolies. He didn't succeed in getting that pushed through. It was one of two amendments that he wanted in there that he didn't get through. So the middle class essentially vanished in the 1880s after the Civil War. Because the railroads started colluding, they got into business with the big corporations that emerged with the growth of the railroads in the 1860s, 1870s, that were basically the wholesalers of food. The farmers had to go through them now instead of just selling to their local markets. And the result of this was the destruction of the family farm, the beginning of the end of a middle class based on agriculture. And the farmers got so angry, they started the Grange movement in the 1870s. In 1872, they split off from the Republican Party not the Grange movement, but the progressive and populist movement split off from the Republican Party, because up until 1872, the Republican Party, starting with Lincoln, had been kind of the party of reform. But they became so corrupt under the Ulysses S. Grant administration, with all these railroad bribery scandals, that the progressive and populist movements erupted in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900, and they led to, in 1917, as I recall, the direct election of the Senate. The Senate used to be appointed by the states. And in 1920, allowing women to vote, because the populists and progressives thought, get women into this thing, and they'll be on the side of having a middle class, too, because they wanted their families to work and all that sort of thing. At least that was the thinking. But the middle class got wiped out, because without the free land, there wasn't a middle class. And so Franklin Roosevelt came along in the 30s, and he said, I agree with Jefferson, we need a middle class, but we can't do it based on agriculture anymore. We have now an industrial society. So the way to create a middle class is with minimum wage laws and allowing unionization. The Supreme Court back in 1913 had ruled that minimum wage laws were unconstitutional. So he packed the court with people who would say minimum wage laws were okay. And passed legislation defining a minimum wage, banning child labor, defining the work week, saying you had to pay overtime if people worked. And in 1935, pushed through the Wagner Act, which allowed unions to form. And boom, this explosion of unionization. From 1935 to the 1950s, we went from 0 to 35% of the American workforce being unionized. And whatever percentage is unionized in an identical amount, roughly, will have the benefits of unionization, just because non-union companies are competing for employees. So we had about 70% of Americans could raise a family, have health care, educate their kids, have a retirement. It was, and then it started to collapse. It started to slowly decline. 1947, the Taft-Hartley Act took a chunk out of it, took a bite out of it, said states don't have to participate. And then Reagan came to power. 25% of America was unionized when Reagan came to power, and now it's 8%. The conservatives declared war on the American middle class, and we are now seeing the results of this. And the administration says, stop complaining. We got to give money to corporations. Forget about seniors. Forget about, pharmaceuticals. No. Got to go to GM. 10 minutes before the hour.
How can there be hope when millions starve in a world of plenty? How can there be justice when the rich parade their wealth before the poor? How can there be peace when each man is his neighbor's enemy? In a world of chaos, peace is possible, but only if we address the root causes of our global crisis, poverty, hunger, and despair. We must share the world's resources to create justice. Without justice, there can be no peace. Fortunately, we're not alone in our efforts. According to futurist Benjamin Krem, a group of them on the emergence of the teachers, call toll-free 888-242-8272. Again, that's 888-242-8272.
The Founding Fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The Founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back, and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide, and you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
Are you or a loved one making too many trips to the bathroom? Listen closely because you're not alone. Over 30 million men suffer from an enlarged prostate. That's why if you make frequent trips to the bathroom, have urgency, hesitancy, or a diminished sex drive, then Super Prostate Formula is for you. It was designed by nationally recognized physician Dr. Michael Toplitzky. The results with his patients have been amazing. Reclaim control now and join the thousands of satisfied customers who have had incredible results with Super Prostate Formula. When you order 2 bottles of Dr. Toplitzky's Super Prostate Formula, you'll also get 2 bottles of his Super Libido Formula, an all-natural alternative to Viagra to enhance sexual vitality and performance, plus his book, Complete Guide to Prostate Health, and his newsletter, a total $100 value free as your gift. Guaranteed or your money back. If you're not completely satisfied, return it for a full refund and keep his Libido Formula book and newsletter free as your gift. Not available in stores. Call now, 800-452-0978. 800-452-0978. That's 800-452-0978.
A leading environmentalist says a growing gap between haves and have-nots is at the root of international terrorism. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Resentment is on the rise around the world, according to Paul Ehrlich, and it's directed at the world's wealthiest societies. Ehrlich and his wife Anne have written a new book called Driving Terrorism.
9/11 should have been more than catastrophic enough to open our eyes to dealing with the roots of terrorism. After all, we live in a world where something like 3 billion people live on $2 a day or less, while the average European cow is subsidized to a tune of $2.50 a day.
Ehrlich says he's not justifying acts of terrorism, but he says we should figure out what drives it. Most of the people drawn to terrorist groups come from desperately poor communities in places like Pakistan.
The basic root of terrorism, of course, is that many, many people are getting educated in poor countries but have no prospects for decent livings, and there are even more people who are not educated who basically just feel desperate and see the vast wealth of the rich countries, and that tends to enrage them.
Ehrlich says it's in our own interest to help fight poverty and disease in developing countries.
The gap between the rich and the poor, which is growing in the United States and between nations in many cases, is something we all should be concerned about, because remember, not only are the poor more susceptible to diseases that can move to us, but of course they also are now armed with nuclear weapons, with biological weapons, with chemical weapons, and so they are able to make lots of diseases that can move to us, but of course they also are now armed with nuclear weapons, with biological weapons, with chemical weapons, and so they are able to make lots of trouble for us, even if we thought it were ethical for us to continue to live high on the hog while they starve.
That's Paul Ehrlich, author of the new book, One with Nineveh. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
You know, some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. And other things just make you swear and curse. When you don't know how things turn out, but
it really is.
Always look on the light side of life.
And frankly, more pleasant. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Chuck in New Mexico is on the line. Hey, Chuck, what's up?
Same things. I think devastated economically, and we really were a powerhouse. So in many ways, it almost created a special purpose environment for us to create a middle class between, say, 1945 and 1960.
You're suggesting that the middle class was a result of our producing products that we then exported to those countries? Is that what you meant?
Well, either that or that they were not able to produce products that we were importing into this country, perhaps a combination thereof. But certainly, we really had the only undamaged economy when you get right down to it. We were not bombed. We weren't atomic bombed. We weren't firebombed. And, you know, maybe that contributed to some extent towards economic isolation.
That had some, you know, you're right in identifying that as a small variable, but it's really a very small one. Our international trade was, you know, a very small percentage of GDP. It was certainly under 10%. I'd have to go back and look at the numbers, but probably under 6%. I remember when Smoot-Hawley was passed, in 1930, which Herbert Hoover had pushed so hard for, it dropped international trade from 3% of GDP to something like 2.3%. So it was a fairly minimal impact. And people say, well, that caused the Great Depression. No, sorry, it had happened after the Great Depression. They say it prolonged the Great Depression. No, actually, you look at it, it looks like Smoot-Hawley either was a neutral effect or actually might have contributed to rebuilding the United States. My solution to this is that instead of having American workers compete with Chinese workers who are terrified in prison camps, American workers should be competing with American workers. We need to roll back what Bill Clinton did with NAFTA and GATT and go back to rational trade policies. But
thanks for clarifying that,
sure.
Tom. I was wondering.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for the call, Chuck. I got a boogie here. Thanks for listening to the program today and being a part of it, those of you who have called. Thanks to Louise for producing our program, to Ira for Ira Gravatt for engineering it, answering our phones. Thanks to Shelby for streaming us around the planet on radiopower.org. Thanks to our sponsors, particularly Small Dog Electronics, for being with us today. The Committee for the Advancement of Stem Cell Research, Benjamin Krim, thank you for sponsoring the program. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up. And thanks to Jay for our music. Thanks to you. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
While the world seems to be collapsing around us, there is hope. Tom Hartman's inspiring book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, has just been re-released. The new updated version is available now and offers solutions to the issues that concern us most: eco-damage, genetic engineering, virulent disease, the end of cheap oil, water shortages, global famine, wars. We can still do something about it and create a world that will work for us and our children's children. As the inspiration for Leonardo DiCaprio's web movie, Global Warning, The Last Hours of Ancient